Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Judea to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. We have a great show for you today, filled with interesting things from a speech that I gave at the Hartman Institute. Ben Bresky is going to join us for an interesting segment about the Tomb of the Patriarchs, the Matriarchs in Hebron. And the one and only Malka Fleischer joins us right now. Shalom.
Hello.
So nice to have you with us.
Yes, it's good to be here.
So, yeah, you know, there's anti-Semitism is like big today. It's like big.
Yeah, it's a topic.
It's more than a topic. It's a reality.
It's like what we're all talking about. Like 10 years ago, we were not talking about anti-Semitism that much.
Right.
But now it's like a thing.
So like Adidas has taken $150 million of its gains, of its profits from the Kanye West shoes and have given it now to fight anti-Semitism. That's pretty cool. But that also goes to show you what I've learned is that like the Kanye West stuff was when he started saying that, whatever he started saying, then it really did affect a lot of places, especially on campus, where it became cool again to be anti-Semitic. Then the October 7th attack, you would think the world would be shocked by, you know, the horrors and would fight. But no, they actually understood it differently, which was this is a great opportunity to destroy Israel. And we've started with the October 7th attacks. Did you see that at the Oscars, Malka, there was a pin of this red hand?
Yes.
Did you see this?
I saw the red hand, yeah.
This red hand.
Jews were horrified.
This red hand was the bloody hand of terrorism and murder now being used as a promotion for resistance against Israel. It's like an amazing turnaround. It's like yeah, we're owning the terrorism. It's now resistance. The killing, murdering
there
people.
There were these pins, and it made the news, but it wasn't that widespread. There were like thousands of people at this.
Just give it a chance.
There were like 8 people wearing this pin.
Yeah. Okay. It starts small. It starts small and it gets bigger. Okay, it gets bigger. And what is the pin saying? It normalizes the death of Jews, the murder of Jews. That's how it goes. That's how it goes. It's the campuses don't like Jews.
That is true. The campuses really don't like Jews.
Yeah. And it's now so at the Oscars, you know, and then there was a guy at the Oscars who renounced his Judaism.
No, that is not. Look,
I saw it also.
Did you watch the speech?
I did.
Whatever, it's a machloket. I personally don't want to give overly too much attention to this person because it's a director of a movie. Like, this is not a person who impacts my life. But he's a Jewish guy who says that my understanding was that he said he doesn't want his Jewishness and the Holocaust being used by Israel in order to commit the horrific atrocities that Israel naturally does every day.
Right.
Not that he was renouncing his Judaism, that he didn't want Judaism to be, he didn't want Israel to co-opt his Judaism.
Okay, so basically he was turncoating on his country, on his peoplehood.
Right, in public.
In public, at the Oscars.
Right.
Which, it's cute, Monica, that you think that it doesn't impact you. That's nice for you. But the bottom line is that the Oscars is a major event.
Right.
And a major cultural event. And this guy just made a movie about the Holocaust, and it's like, this pathos that some American Jews have,
really
that some American
like
Jews
a
have,
Holocaust perpetrator,
right, and it's just like, so you're making a movie about the Holocaust, you win a prize, then you equate Israel to doing the Holocaust. It's like, why don't you just like not get involved in the first place? It's like, what a, and so by the way, one other thing, Mark, which you failed to mention, which is that a lot of people clapped for that speech,
right,
where he, yes, renounces Judaism, yes, disconnected it from Israel, and just made such a mishmash. Now, all you need now is millions of pro-Philistine Arabs and pro-Pali, liberal, progressive folks to be like, look, here's this very successful director who just won an Oscar. He also is disgusted by Israel. And more and more, we're slipping right now into this quagmire. I got to tell you, Hamas may be taking it on the chin right now vis-a-vis the war in Gaza. But vis-a-vis public relations, dang. Nice.
Right. It's pretty impressive to be able to walk into somebody's house, do the most horrific crimes against them, and 1,200 of their friends. and then come out as heroes.
Right. And then have, you know, a President Biden be like, yeah, Israel's got to stop these atrocities and all that kind of stuff. It's like this has been a very serious smash against Israel, against our beautiful and beloved Israel. And I take heart in all these amazing folks. Obviously the Israeli soldiers are strong. But also, like, I love these congressmen who just tell off these little hecklers.
Right,
and just say
been
to
a
them,
few videos like that.
Yeah, they just say to them, just, yeah. The best one is Brian Mast, a friend of mine, congressman from Florida, who said, he's like, he turns around to these people, he's like, you know where we stand on terrorism? And the person's like, what? And he goes again, do you know where we stand on terrorism? And the person's like, where? He says, on their necks.
Nice.
Yeah, that's what he says. And I like that. I like that. I like that. And here's a guy that has no legs because his legs were blown off in Afghanistan. And he's a pro-Israel guy, strong pro-Israel guy. And yesterday I had Sarah Carter and Tony Perkins and important folks visit me in Hebron. And that was also, there was a great energy there of pro-Israel folks, strong pro-Israel folks in Israel, in Judea and Samaria. Part of the Keep God's Land initiative. But in terms of like how the country is rolling right now, you know, it's, we're not on the winning end of the narrative out there for young people and young people's hearts on campus and at these places. It's not like, let's put it this way. Nobody got up there at the Oscars and was like, Hamas attacked us. It's now time to cleanse the land of jihadism. Retake the ancestral homeland and fight back the bad guys, crush them, and thereby create an atmosphere where all peoples around here who are subjugated by the jihad will be liberated, and there will be an Abrahamic region led by Israel, a strong Israel on its land. Nobody got up and said that. You know what I mean? The best we can do right now, the best that we could do is say, bring them home. That's the best that we could do out there. That's the toughest phrase out there for Jews.
Right. Unfortunately, we do not have this is a criticism, Isha, that you and I have had about the Israel project forever, right? For 20 years, is that we don't have message discipline. And we don't even have like policy discipline. I'll give you an example. And this is not to criticize victims, okay? But there was supposed to be a very special event that was going to happen in Flatbush, New York. I think it was Flatbush. No, Teaneck?
No, there was two events. There was one in Teaneck and one, I think, in the Five Towns, I think.
Right. Okay. It says here, welcome to the Great Israeli Real Estate Event, proclaims a colorful poster listing dates for the event in Montreal, Toronto, Teaneck, Lawrence, and Flatbush. So there was a series of events that was going to happen in different places. Including in Teaneck, New Jersey. Now, Teaneck, New Jersey is not a super wealthy place, but it's pretty affluent. A lot of people who like make Aliyah, and definitely a lot of people who might find themselves in the position to invest in like a second property in Israel or something like that. Zionist people, oftentimes Torah people, traditional people, not Haredi, but Zionists. And so a great place to have an event where you're trying to sell Israel real estate.
Wait, just want to make it clear. You said not Haredi. It's not ultra-Orthodox. It's certainly modern Orthodox. Yeah. But it's very close to Passaic and other places.
Right.
It's like, it's very much in the Orthodox Welt.
I mean, but what I really intended to say that it is entrenched in this modern world and it is hip to the vibe and stuff. It operates within its community. Anyway, they were supposed to have this event, and what happened was that Hamas people came out, and they, like, terrorized these people a little bit. Not horribly, but they came out, these pro-Hamas people came out to protest the event, and the people of Teaneck were told, don't, like, stand up to these people overly. Don't get in their grill. Happens to be that a few Jewish people did come out wearing like Israeli flags on their backs, you know, these like awesome guys who are not going to take something like that lying down. But not really. There wasn't like a strong Jewish response, basically. Then there was another event that was supposed to happen in Flatbush. they were going to have another real estate event in Flatbush, but the police met with the community and were like, listen, we're concerned that there's going to be a blowback because, you know, Israel real estate. And basically the Jewish community and the police came to the conclusion that, I'll give you, it's a multiple choice answer. Okay. Ready, Yishai? What is the answer? A, that we hope for the best. We're going to go forward with the event and hope for the best. B, we are going to beef up security. Chaval al hazman. If anybody so much as looks at you in a funny way, we're going to step on their face and take them to jail. Or C, you are going to cancel your event because we do not want to deal with anti-Israel sentiment and violence. Which one do you think it was?
Oh, I think it's D. You missed one, which is let them come. Come and take it. Come closer. Come over here so that we can make a fight and make an example of you and show you what happens when you come to our community. And that's when the lead pipes come out, and that's when you really fight and you say to everybody, like, not just defense, not beef up defense. We're going to start with you. You're going to come and proclaim jihadism in our town. You're going to come and say that you're in favor of October 7th. Well, we got a message for you as well. We have a thing that we have a way that we deal with people like you with pure jihadist evil that wants to subjugate us. So,
and we're going to protect ourselves and the whole community around us and who will be our next target.
Right. And we're going to send a signal to all the baddies.
So you're saying it was D. That was a trick question.
It was D.
It was not D.
Oh, God.
It was C.
Which one was C?
C was the police and the Jewish community decide that there is not going to be an event. No event.
You mean the Jews and the police canceled the event and because the baddies threatened them? That doesn't make sense to me.
The police told the Jews, we would rather you not.
Yeah, I got it.
And the Jews were like, okay.
Yeah.
Additionally, here's a quote. I don't know who these people are.
I just want to.
Here's what it says. It says, additionally, this is a quote. The Rabbanim, the rabbis, the Rabbanim are asking all those who are planning to counter protest to please not attend as the event is not going forward tomorrow.
Okay. I want to say
that what we're talking about here is intimidation campaigns that are occurring in New York, New Jersey successfully with the cooperation of the Jewish community. God forbid, I am not saying that the Jewish community is trying to intimidate the Jewish community, but I am saying they are completely playing into the hands of the people who are trying to intimidate them. The Jews wanted to have a nice event about property in Israel. And the Hamas was like, you better not. And then the Jews were like, you're right. The end. That's the end of the story. And I think to myself, Isha, you know, here in Israel, most people who have a permit for a gun have a permit for one gun. But I know in America, people can get guns. Like, how is it possible that Jews are not like they're going to come at us? We're all showing up to shul with our guns. I don't understand how it is. And then the rabbis go, don't even counter protest. Don't say anything, Jews. Jews, go lock yourselves in the basement, Jews. How can it be?
A few things. Number one is Teaneck is New Jersey. New Jersey, there's barely any guns. And it's not easy to get a gun permit. That's number one.
All right. I grew up in Texas, so right. Maybe my perception
one.
Is
Number
off.
Two is guns are not the point here because this is not going to be a gunfight. This is going to be a brawl. And they're not coming out with terrorists. They're coming to protest and be pro October 7th. And the point is that what needed to be done is to do a show of force. And a show of force and come out with the flags and with everything and do it and say, you know what? We're doing the real estate fair outdoors. Here we are, right here.
Right,
here
we're serving falafel.
Here we are. Oh, you know what? We're going to move into a bigger venue here. We're going to a stadium. Everybody's coming.
I just can't believe.
Wait.
Yeah.
But I do want to say to you that I can understand, at least, a Jewish leader who thinks the other way. Here's how he thinks. He thinks to himself like this. He thinks, these protesters are here today, gone tomorrow. Let's just keep living our lives. We don't need a big ruckus here. We don't need to start a whole big fight here. We'll just kind of like, let's quiet the whole thing down. And then I hear, I want you to know that I spoke to a New Jerseyan from Passaic, a good friend of mine named Donnie today. And he said to me, look, the politicians, even the Orthodox Jewish politicians in the area are all Democrats. They all need that Arab vote.
Oh, my God.
And all that. They all need so they're caught between a rock and a hard place.
In order to what? Like, what are they getting elected for if they can't even run a stinking real estate event? Like, what good is your election into these places?
Why? We averted a problem, you know, this and that. They can rationalize it. I'm just telling you that when you go into it a little bit deeper, you realize that they didn't have a lot of political cover. And the police are like, what do we need this fight for? And everybody wanted
what do they need the fight for? That's not their job to decide what fight they need.
That's right.
It's their job to protect
freedom,
loving people, and freedom, doing what they're doing while they're doing it.
You're totally right. But you have to push for that. And
it feels to me like a dangerous precedent, though, Ishai. I'll be
honest
with you.
Of course.
It's like you're trying. I get that the concept, which is you're trying to protect Jews from getting hurt by horrible, unscrupulous people. Okay? I do understand that. At the same time, like, what kind of culture are you creating inside the Jewish community where you're telling people, like, never mind, just be quiet. Just sit quietly.
There's a sissy culture out there. Do you really think that?
But it's only going to lead to danger.
That's the natural mode. That's the natural mode for a lot of these people. That's their natural tendency. And I can even understand it, but that is their natural tendency.
Well, Ishai, you know, they in New Jersey, they got these Hamas supporters who are, like, irritating. By the way, I just want to skip back. This is not a smooth transition, but I want to skip back to the Kanye story. I looked into it a little bit more. They're trying to fight anti-Semitism. Do you know which organizations they gave their money to? They gave their money to two organizations. One is called the Anti-Defamation League, which I would not call a successful anti-Semitism organization at all.
Right.
The second organization is called the Phil O'Neese and Keita Floyd Institute for Social Change, run by social justice advocate Phil O'Neese Floyd, the brother of George Floyd.
Okay.
I'm just saying that I'm not sure how much anti-Semitism will evaporate after this, but
all these organizations don't understand. They don't understand. There's something so – I wish people would understand that there is a panacea. There is a panacea, but people don't understand it. There is one answer to all these things, and the answer is, if you want to fight anti-Semitism – education is nice. All these things are nice. But if you really want to fight anti-Semitism, there's only one answer, which is the panacea, which is a strong Jewish people, a strong Israel. Fight them hard. Embarrass them. Crush them. You know, make them small. Take back their whole constantly push back on their whole thing. Laugh at Hamas. Show them who they are. A bunch of baby killers and women rapers and that hide in tunnels and while their leaders are all billionaires. Make fun of them. Make fun of them, and give them no quarter. And that's the problem with the Jews that we and the whole attitude towards this thing is like, you could have used this opportunity to go big. You know, I have this. Right. You know the slogan I have.
Even just you talking about it this way, like, gives me pain in my stomach because I just to think about the wasted opportunity hurts so much.
Do you know about my slogan, Malka?
Which one?
Go big and go home.
Nice.
You know, like, you like that?
Yeah.
Go big and go home. I have to write that down.
Going home.
Yeah.
This is a crazy story that I just saw for the first time today.
Yeah.
South Africa threatens citizens fighting in the IDF with arrest if they return home.
That's nice.
Here's the story in a little more detail. South Africa's foreign minister, Naledi Pandor, has vowed that citizens of South Africa, their own citizens, okay, who fight in the Israel Defense Forces will be arrested upon returning to the country. Do you believe that? You went out because you are a dual citizen. You went out to fight for Israel's survival. You come home and you get arrested. It says, she said, I have already issued a statement alerting those who are South African and who are fighting alongside or in the Israeli Defense Forces. Hang on, I got to pop up. We are ready. When you come home, we're going to arrest you. That's it. Can you believe that? South Africa is all done. Yeah. If you are listening to us from South Africa, I hope they will be holding an Israel real estate event near you so that you can get out of there. It does not sound like a hospitable environment anymore.
Yeah. It's all from the creation of, you know, and I, you know who yelled at me just today?
Who?
Our one of our beloved teachers, thinkers, leaders, and activists, Nadia Matar.
She yelled at you?
Well, she gave me a talking to.
What? And, why?
She gave me a come to Abraham talk.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. Came to Abraham. Go ahead. Come on, people are paying for their show here. Let's go. Yeah.
She told me that we have to always talk about sovereignty. She said to me, you constantly have to mention sovereignty. You see, you have to say that the only, like whenever you give little talks, everywhere you go, you have to say, there's only one solution to this business, which is Jewish sovereignty in our land. That's the way forward. That's the only, and I'll play you the recording that she left me. She's like, that's the only way forward. And we have to constantly say to people that we have created with our own hands this Palestinian Authority because we didn't assert sovereignty.
We're not ready for sovereignty, right?
And that we didn't assert. We were ready, but we didn't assert sovereignty. And the only reason that there's terrorists in the land is because we didn't assert sovereignty, et cetera, et cetera. And so therefore, really right now, it's really the time for a tikkun, for fixing it. And the only way to do it is through asserting sovereignty. And so, yeah, she gave me a come to Abraham talk. So,
nice. Okay.
Is that the way to say it? Did I say it right?
I think so. Yeah, I can't say it the other way. So,
you know, that's what we got to do. Malka, I want to really thank the folks that make the show happen. The folks that dedicate money and their hard-earned support through buymeacoffee.com/Yishai. Thank you very much. Thank you to my good friend, Krista.
Thank you so much, Krista.
Thank you to my good friend, David, who listens to the show while exercising.
Good for you.
My good friend, David, who is... And you know what David reminds me of? He reminds me that there are so many warriors for Israel. And they come in all kinds of shapes and sizes.
That's right.
They could be monks in a monastery. They could be doing their cycling right now and getting out there, lobbying Congress, connecting with pro-Israel people, strengthening them. There are those guys who go into the old school Jewish organizations, the Jewish Agency and stuff like that, in order to bring them back into the nationalist way of thinking, into a spiritual and right-wing way of thinking. There's all kinds of warriors out there. There's all kinds of warriors. And I just want to bless you warriors out
there. That's right.
All the warriors out there.
I just want to say, by the way, sometimes people think that in order to be a warrior, you need to have like a big, massive Twitter following, or you need to have like your own podcast, or you need to be the leader of some big organization or something like that. That is not correct. And you need to know that if you are out there listening, and if you are speaking to one person, or if you are putting out something on your Facebook, or if you're giving strength to your kids or your kids' friends, if you are calling somebody on the phone and telling them to be strong, and telling them what to look forward to, if you are giving your $18 to a worthy cause, then you are a warrior too, and you should not minimize yourself.
Warriors need to eat mental warrior food. They need the right news from the right place. So I do recommend that people check out JNS.org and JewishPress.com. You'll get the correct perspective, the healthy perspective. So I recommend that very much. I also want to thank the Land of Israel Network, which this show is part of. And I want to thank also every warrior and hero needs a spiritual center. That spiritual center is Yerushalayim, Yer Kodesh, the city, the eternal city, the golden city. And that city, the heart of it has the Temple Mount. People like my friend David just say, next time you come in Israel, he just makes people go on that Temple Mount. And a good way to go on the Temple Mount is buymeacoffee.com. Oh, I meant to say high in the heart.com.
Yes, high in the heart.
which is run by MJ, who was on that CBS
Spend
interview.
Spend your time up there praying, not buying coffee.
There you go. No. That's spiritual coffee.
Right.
You get the spiritual
suntan.
Yeah, you get
suntan. Spiritual caffeination.
That's right. Spiritual caffeination. That's like a song. It's like a song from the 60s. Anyway, so that's highonthehard.com. And, of course, connecting to the mamas and the papas, the founders, and King David's first capital, which is Hebron. And we keep that place strong through hebronfund.org. Okay, I got a chance to speak with an important group. Excuse me, a little
got
bit of
allergies.
Yeah, yeah, I got the allergies.
Springtime in Israel.
Springtime in Israel, and
we didn't get no snow this year.
No, but we have a lot of greens this year. A lot of yellow flowers. A lot of that stuff. A lot of the allergens are in the air right now. It's all good. Thank you to my good friends at Flixonase. For helping me get through
GlaxoSmithKline or whatever.
Galactica. Yeah. And whatever you call it.
Thank you.
I did get a chance to speak to a young group, and this is from the Shalom Hartman Institute, which is really on the left side of the spectrum. And they bring me in, they bring you in from time to time to speak, and I got a chance to speak to them. This is one of those speeches that, like, I'm speaking to kids who are often on the other side. These speeches are useful. That's what I'm putting it out there. One could say, Yishai, why are you putting your speeches out? Don't you want people to invite you to speak and stuff like that? Like, listen, forget that. It's just too important right now to know how to answer. And so here's my talk.
Although, of course, you should invite Yishai to speak.
That's right. By the way, I am available to come to your synagogue, place of worship, club, whatever it
real
is.
Real estate event.
That's right, real estate event. Oh, I would love that.
I wish they could have had you out on a soapbox out in front of that real estate event.
Oh, my gosh. And with a microphone
and with some awesome Jews who just are itching to get out there with their Israeli flags flying and stand right up in the eyeballs of the horrible people who want to just bring darkness and backwardness
to
everybody.
Opportunity. That's what people don't understand. When the bad guys come out, it's like Purim. It's an opportunity. It's an opportunity. When the bad guys come out, this is your time to shine. And then you could see them and point them out. What an opportunity. Same thing when I think about the Houthis. I'm like, Houthis? What an opportunity.
Don't they love baseball in New York? Whatever happened to like a baseball bat?
By the way, I want to tell you about the Houthis. My mom told me that the Houthis are actually a pretty formidable. They're like Afghanis.
Really?
They're a pretty formidable.
Like Taliban?
They're like Afghanistan type folks, you know?
Okay.
Any case, here is
what,
my...
What, you just felt like saying that?
Just mean to say that the Houthis are not like just a bunch of ragtag folks that just came around. They're like mountain people that are hard to – they're not easy to get out. But the bottom line is you could have made a show of them. You could have made an example of them and been like, you starting up with Israel? You're calling war against us? Like, no problem. Here we go. You know, and then you could have smashed them, opened up the Red Sea lanes – Saudi Arabia would have been like...
Well, even the United States is not smashing them.
Right. And, well, under Biden, why would they smash any jihadis? And the Saudis would have been like, thank you, shukran katir. Okay? And it would have been like... It would have been a completely different picture here. But in the meantime, we let the bad guys grow. That is a mistake, friends. Don't let the bad guys and their badness fester. That's the lesson. I learned that lesson from a great rabbi. That lesson is don't let the bad guys get big. Smash them while they're little. Okay, and to hear more gems like that, here is my discussion at the Shalom Hartman Institute. I am the spokesman for the Jewish community of Hebron, and we were supposed to have this talk in Hebron. But you guys canceled. Why is that? Why did you cancel?
Our parents wouldn't allow us to go there.
Your parents don't allow you to go there? Okay.
A lot of people don't feel safe enough.
Don't feel safe? Okay, we do it every year.
Yeah.
Every year we do it. Okay.
In the Va'adah, a lot of people were concerned about the possible security risks because Ramadan was just beginning.
Oh, so that's the answer. The Ramadan. So we're scared of the Ramadan. So we're scared of the Ramadan.
Political?
You're afraid of the politics?
Personally,
what is it that we're afraid of? The politics? Do you think somebody's going to...
Not politics, but every time Ramadan sun comes around.
Come on, come on, say it, say it. You know what I'm trying to get to. We're not afraid of the politics. That's not why you're not there today.
You're afraid of the riots of the...
You're afraid of the security. That's just a whitewash word. Say, you're afraid of terrorism. You're afraid somebody's going to shoot and kill you. So just say what it is. Don't say the politics, the political situation. You're afraid a bad guy's going to come and shoot you in the head. That's what you're afraid of. And you think that the Ramadan means more bad guys doing more of that stuff, more likely. So let's just be real about what Ramadan does. It keeps us out of Hebron. Let's be real about what Hamas did down in the south. Let's just see. They came out of Gaza, they burnt houses, and you know what else they did? And now we like went backwards, and now we have we're afraid of them. So a lot of cities are not housed because we have a lot of our people removed, evacuated from those areas, right? So, and the same thing in the north. So basically, the Ramadan, the jihad, the Hamas, they shrink us. They're interested in shrinking us. In fact, that's what I want to talk about today, and I'll get to it in just a second. I just want to know where you guys are from mostly. Where are you from?
London.
London town? Okay, good. Where at?
London.
Where in London? I know London. Finchley? Okay, good. Okay, spoke there once, yeah. Where are you from? Ramle. Huh? Ramle? Yofi, okay. Where are you from?
Connecticut.
Where in Connecticut?
Stanford.
Okay, good. Okay, where are you from?
New York.
Where in New York?
Westchester.
Oh, Westchester. Okay, great. And where are you from?
Ashkelon,
one of my favorite places in the world. Yeah. I love Ashkelon. I love Ashkelon. Really, I love Ashkelon. I think I'm going to be running the 10K, the marathon. No, I think there's a marathon in a month. Is that what you want to call it? Bezrat Hashem. You'll see me from behind, maybe. No, just joking. Okay. I actually just ran the 5K with my 12-year-old son in Jerusalem. It was fun, so fun. Tov Beseder. I was thinking about what to talk with you guys, what to talk with you about today. I was thinking about it. Now, I have the speech that I usually give this group, but then I was like, you know what, right now we have to talk about something a little bit more nikudati, a little bit more specific, and that is, what was the October 7th massacre? What is it? What was it? What happened? Why is that important? Because there's a lot of people that want to draw it in different ways. They want you to believe that it was about the occupation. Or it was about subjugation, or it was about the tzfifut, what do you call it, the tight living conditions in Gaza, right? They give you all these stories about what this thing was really about. So, let me tell you a little bit about how I know Gaza. By the way, the word Gaza, is that a nice word, Gaza? Does that sound nice to you? Like, huh? You know, in the ancient world, Gaza, or Aza, or in Arabic, Raza, was considered one of the most beautiful beaches in the world. It had some of the, when you said Gaza, you're like, I'm going to take you on vacation to Gaza. Wow, okay? And I remember a time where we used to go on vacation, not so long ago, to Gaza, because it was the best beaches. We called it Gush Katif, but it meant Gaza, the Gaza Strip. Okay, let me ask you another word. Lebanon. How does that sound to you? When I say Lebanon, what do you think? Is that a nice word? Does that sound nice to you? Sound like a nice word or not?
Does
not?
It does.
It does, right? Okay. But for your friends, let's say you said the word Lebanon somewhere, you're like, yeah, I went to Lebanon, went to visit Lebanon. How would that sound to them?
Not good,
right? You know that the word Lebanon in Hebrew means beauty? Like, Hahara Levanon, like it's considered to be, it's supposed to like symbolize, the Beit HaMikdash was called HaLevanon, because it was so grand and beautiful. Okay, and it was also made from the trees of the Lebanon. Okay, the Lebanon is something beautiful. But that word has become to mean something bad. Let me ask you another word, Hebron. Hebron, nice word or not nice word? Okay? For today, I tell Hebron, I say that to today on the news, it's like, oh my God, he's talking about a place of violence and jihadism and racism and crazy settlers, right? The word Hebron means chaver. It means, in Arabic, they call it Khalil, which means the same thing, which means friendship. Ibrahim Khalil Allah. Abraham is the friend of Allah. Okay? It's supposed to be a beautiful place. Hebron is an ancient place, 4,500-year-old place. It's supposed to mean something good. Why have these places, Gaza, Hebron, and Lebanon, why have they come to mean these bad things? Why? Why do they mean that? Because I have to go on, I'll answer it for you, okay? Which is, the jihad has taken over these places and turned them into hell. Gaza was not so long ago, in 2005, my wife and I went down to try to block, I was working for Arutz Sheva, Israel National News, we tried to block the country of Israel from removing itself from the Gaza Strip. What did we say back then? What was our rationale? Do you know what we said?
שאם נותנים את זה,
זה יהפוך להיות מוקד של טרור נגדנו. Right? That if we leave Gaza, it'll become a forward base of the jihad. And you know what people said to us? No, it'll never happen. And you see, you'll give them land, they'll be peaceful. And they said to us, you'll see that if they start with us, we'll be really strong. Boom, we're going to smash them. They, you know, the Israeli tough guy talk. And we're like, no guys, no. This is a bad idea. You walk out of your land, your ancestral land, you give it over to the PLO, it'll be taken over by somebody, we didn't know who, was called Hamas. It could have been Al-Qaeda, and it could have been ISIS, and it could have been any of these guys. Same thing, really, there's no difference. Right? Just little difference in ideologies. You give away that land, they will take that land over and make it a forward base of the jihad. We'll get to questions, okay? They'll make it a forward base of the jihad. And so we were like, don't do this. You know who else told us not to do it? The Arabs. The Arabs that I was working with and living next to and dealing with all the time, they were like, through fences, I remember their hands. I just remember this image, that they had their fingers through the fence like this, and they were saying to me, Yishai, they said, don't leave. You don't understand who's going to take over this land. The jihad is going to take over. It's going to squash us average, decent Arabs. It's going to destroy our lives. It's going to take away our freedoms. It's going to also take our children and brainwash them to jihadism. So the Arabs said, don't do it. Don't walk away from your land and turn us over to the jihad. Because these jihadis that are coming, they're going to suppress us. They're going to be violent against us. If we say things like, I think I want to be friends with the Jews, they're going to cream us, crush us, kill us. They're going to take our kids, brainwash them. Don't leave this land. Don't do it. It's dumb. And it's against the rules of the Middle East. There are rules in the Middle East. You don't give up land for peace. You think that sounds, doesn't that sound nice? Here, I'm going to say something nice to you. I have something that's, you know this watch? You see this watch? It's really important to me. It's a really important watch to me. It's my army watch. I want to give you this watch. Even though it's important to me, I want to give it to you for peace, because I want to have peace with you. So take this watch. Does that sound nice? It sounds kind of nice, right? But in the Middle East, what the other side hears is, this guy, Yishai, is a total weakling. He's willing to give up his watch or his land for peace. That means he is spineless. He's willing to give his mother or his wife over to us. He's spineless. He doesn't hold on to what's his. He's not a man. And that's the discussion of the Middle East. And so we said to them, don't do this thing. We tried. All my friends were arrested. I was carried out of my house by the police. Because we were like, listen, we're doing you a favor. Please do not do this. Bad things are going to happen. Go back to the record of 2005. Nobody wants to talk about it today because it's embarrassing. Because they're like, we didn't. Nobody knew. Nobody expected this to happen. Nobody expected something like this to ever happen. Yeah, right? We said it was going to happen. It wasn't we. It wasn't me and my wife. It was a humongous group of people. We went to the Likud, got the Likud to vote against it. The whole, like 70% of the Likud voted against it. We tried that. We tried we tried everything we could to stop this thing from happening. And instead they did it. And what happened? We said it would take a year for the place to be taken over by the jihad. And what happened instead? It took a half a year. A half a year, the Hamas got rid of the PLO. Not that there's any difference between them. They're just the same sides of the two sides of the same coin. One is a suit wearing jihad, and the other one is a jihad, you know, a kafir wearing jihad. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. But the bottom line is that they took it over, and now we had war after war after war. And then finally we got to this place where again, the same people who think in the same way after being hit over and over again, they have what we call in Israel, conceptia, right? They have this concept that somehow things are going to get better. We have a recording of the chief of Israeli intelligence, of the army, saying 3 months before October 7th, saying, Hamas is murta. That means that they are, what's the word? Deterrence. They're deterred. And that they want governance and peace. We have them saying that. In the meantime, they're planning for a year or 2 years this big attack on us. And our heads of intelligence, you know, that Israeli intelligence, you know, Shmona Matayim, they know everything. They don't know shit, okay? They don't know what's going on right under their nose. And we, a guy like me who was a paratrooper and not in intelligence, is like, I think they're building tunnels to destroy us. I think they're making an army to fight against us. Stop being so naive and dumb. Stop being so naive and dumb. Stop sending money from Qatar to fund these guys. Stop giving them cement and other things. You know where it's going. Stop allowing UNRWA to teach them jihadism. Stop. Stop doing stupid things. Look at the big, look where this is going. And our vaunted intelligence was unable to identify that these guys are building a whole tunnel system underneath in order to create this horrible thing. Ladies and gentlemen, isn't it a nice day today? I just walked here from a distance. You know how nice of a day it is? It's really nice. I mean, really, really, really nice. And at the same time, we have what? 130 hostages? 134. How many? We have land that we've lost, basically, because the jihadists pushed us back and now we're afraid of them. We got kids in the classroom in a beautiful place in Yerushalayim. We're afraid to go to Hebron because the jihad controls there and because it's Ramadan. And we say all kinds of words in order to not say what we really mean. Oh, because of Ramadan, because of political... You mean you're scared of the bad guys who have taken over large chunks of land. Let's just say what it is. Let's just say what's really going on around here. I used to speak in America. I speak in America a lot. I used to speak before October 7th. And people would be like, Ishai, you're a little bit exaggerating. You know, Israel's the strongest country around here in the Middle East. You got the biggest army and the biggest economy. And I was like, you know what? That's your perspective. That is not my perspective. My perspective is we have 150,000 rockets aimed at us from Lebanon. We have whatever's happening in Gaza. This was before October 7th. These guys are preparing for war against us. In Judea and Samaria, the so-called West Bank, they're arming themselves to the teeth and teaching jihadism to children. Then you got the Iranian nuclear bomb. You got these dudes called the Houthis that want to cut off our waterway system. You got the American campus, the jihad working to scare the Jewish kids into submission. Kids at Cooper Union are in a library because the jihad is banging on the windows and they're all scaredy-like, okay? I said to them, I don't think our situation is that great. I don't think our situation is that great. People would be like, oh man, you're just like a right-wing extremist guy. You're just exaggerating. I'm just like, you're the one who's exaggerating. You want to make a worldview which is like an imagination. You want to think you're the biggest. You want to think you're some kind of, you know, you're in charge of everything, but you're not. And you're not seeing the bad guys as they walk another step and another step towards what they really ultimately want, which is to annihilate to shrink the Jewish state and then to annihilate it. And the problem is that we want to live in our little imagination. It's a very nice garden here at Hartman. Very nice. I love it here. I want to come here all the time. But I'm telling you that if you walk just a few kilometers this way in Yerushalayim, there are no-go zones in Jerusalem. There are neighborhoods that you cannot go in with a kippah. Okay? It's called Isawiya. Okay? It's called Jabal Mukaber. It's called Atur and many others and what are they called over there? Beit Hanina. What's it called next to Beit Hanina? There's tons of neighborhoods around here you can't go into in Jerusalem. Let's say you just felt like strolling today because you just felt like it. You just want to go to the Temple Mount because you're just feeling that way today. You're at Hartman. You had a class. You felt something good. You wanted to go to the Temple Mount. You can't. You can't go. And if you went and you looked too Jewishy, then they wouldn't let you. They would give you very limited time, surround you by police, and wouldn't let you pray up there. That's the situation. And if we would just stop like imagining things to be different. Now, the bad guys, they don't want to make it look like what they're really after is what? Ethnic cleansing of the Jewish people. They say that in Arabic plenty. Plenty. But they don't want to say that in English. They want to appeal to good folks like people in this classroom, and your parents, and even the teachers here. They want to appeal to that, and they want to say, no, 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 this isn't about jihad. We don't want to kill Jews. What do we really want? We really want a two-state solution. We want a Palestine and Israel to live side by side. I can't find one map that they actually show a two-state solution, because every time I see any map, including if you buy in the Old City, it's just a picture of Israel, exactly like Israel, but it says Palestine on it. What do you think that's supposed to mean? What is that supposed to mean to me? If I see a picture of Israel, the map of Israel, but it says Palestine, what do you think that means? Huh, I don't know. What could it mean? Maybe they want equal rights. Maybe they want to live side by side. And maybe they don't like the occupation. Or maybe they just want to get rid of the whole occupation, which if you ask most of these jihad Arabs, you ask them, when does the occupation start? Have you ever asked an Arab? Ask one of these Arabs that says the word occupation to you. Say, when did it start? They'll be damned if they don't say 1948. They'll always say 1948. Sometimes, if you're on CNN and you're a Palestinian Authority person, you'll say 1967, but that's so that the liberals will buy it. But on the maps, and among, even to you, they'll tell you straight out, the occupation starts in 1948. Okay, so now we have a situation where it all blew up in our face. All these conceptions blew up in our face. All these folks around Gaza envelope who believed that everything was going to be honky-dory and all we have to do is keep giving them opportunities and rights and feed them in a million things, it blew up in their face. So now there's a new bad guy. Who's the new bad guy in Israel? Who should be the bad guy? The bad guy in Israel should be the folks that for the last 30 years have been telling us, no, it's not important to have a lot of land. You can shrink. It's okay. Give them control of these places. Let's bring in Yasser Arafat. Give him control of huge chunks of land. Give him arms. Right? So obviously, people like myself have been saying forever how dumb that is. It's dumb to bring in your enemies and arm them. That's dumb. It's dumb to give them your ancestral homeland and let them take it over. That's dumb. It's dumb to give them Gaza to control. They're going to turn it into a forward haven of jihadism. Don't do that. So now the people who have been pushing that forever have a new bad guy. Who's the new bad guy? The Haredim. The ultra-Orthodox. That's the new bad guy. The reason October 7th happened, according to this new theory that's being pushed down the last 2 weeks, is because the Haredim didn't join the army. Not because you have been shrinking our army and have been pulling it out of places and letting the bad guys take over. No, that's not the problem. The problem is these black hatters. Anyway, nobody likes them. They're weird anyway, right? So, you know, might as well, you know, and anyway, they're shirking their national responsibility. Let's blame them. Instead of looking inward and saying, Chatati, Aviti, Pashati, I have sinned in this horrible thing that we've allowed to happen in the last 40, 50 years, which is to give away our land to our enemies and not be strong in our land. All this business about occupation, all this business about rights, equalities, all this business is a veil. It's a sham. It's a show. It's a show to try to get nice Jewish kids like yourselves, smart Jewish kids like yourselves, to think that we haven't done enough and that we should give away more rights, give away more responsibilities, and by doing this kind of appeasement will somehow calm them down. It hasn't worked for over 100 years. You know, in 1929 in Hebron, where I'm from, where I work, 1929, we had a riot. There was no Jewish state. There was no occupation. There was a tiny Jewish minority living in Hebron. And a riot came and killed 67 Jews. You know how they did it? Beheadings, rapes, stuffing the cook into the baker into the oven and burning him. Same stuff. Same exact stuff. For a lot of people in Israel, people are like, I can't believe how barbaric the Hamas are. And I'm like, you clearly do not read history. You just don't know what's going on. You don't understand this region. If you understood this region, had a little bit of a historical perspective, you know that that's what they've been doing for a long time to try to scare us, bully us, kick us off our land. My friends, I'm sorry to say this. The reason you're not in Hebron today is because you've been bullied off your land. That's the reason that you didn't go see the tomb of the forefathers and mothers, Abraham and Sarah, Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob and Leah, which are the parents of all of us. Which are the parents of all of us. At the end, what are we Jewish? And even if there's people amongst you, I don't know who's here in the crowd, even people who are not Jewish, everybody is the children of Abraham in the sense that we follow, you know, the Abrahamic path in this world. My point is that why are you not there today? Because you've been scared off by people who don't want you to go there and connect with your land. They terrorize us. What is terror? What does the word terror mean? Terror is the broadcasting of fear. It's making fear go further. Like, probably you've never been in an attack in Hebron, right? Right? You have not been in an attack in Hebron, right? Am I guessing? But you have the fear of an attack in Hebron has spread to you or your group, and you're now not coming there. So I came here today because I didn't want to deprive you of a little bit of Hebron, okay? And not deprive you of myself, of course. But the point is I want to be honest about what the situation is. We live scared. We live defensively. My counteroffer is, let's not live that way. My counteroffer is, let's live like Middle Easterners. Let's push back on the bad guys. Nobody wants to take away their land. We want our land. We want our land. And I'll say the end right now, which is, there is a simple solution for peace. It's simple. It's so simple that smart kids cannot believe how simple it is. It's just this simple. A strong Jewish Israel on its land, surrounded by strong Arab countries on their land, working together for a better Middle East. No cutting away land, no giving away our ancestral homeland, no empowering the jihad. We live on our tribal ancestral lands. They live in their lands nearby, and we work together for a better future. Like the Abraham Accords began to do. Like maybe we'll have with Saudi Arabia. That's the future. The future is not cut away your land. Now, I don't see any Asian folks here. The reason I say that is because when there's Asian folks, a lot of times I say to them, I have a solution for you for the Taiwan problem, okay? You guys know what Taiwan is? It's a little island right outside of big China, okay? It's a little island. Now, China wants to swallow up tiny little Taiwan. It wants to swallow it all the time. And Taiwan's like, no, we want to be independent, right? They kicked them out of the UN. You know that Taiwan is not in the UN? Lucky them, right? But they're not in the UN because, you know, China didn't want them there. So they're not in the UN. There's this tiny island. So when there's Asian people, I always say to them, here's a solution for Taiwan. Let's just cut half of Taiwan, the little tiny island, let's cut in half, give it to China. I'm sure that will make China happy and satisfied. And everybody that's Asian always goes, ha, 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 that's absurd. That is so silly. Of course, that's a joke. Everybody knows that they want to eat us all up. If you give them half, they'll take the rest later. Same thing. I was in Washington, D.C., hanging out with a guy who's a Kurdish activist. Now, the Kurds are a people. They're a big people, and they don't even have exactly a country, but they have, Baruch Hashem, been able to eke out a little piece of independence existence in northern Iraq called autonomous Iraqi Kurdistan, okay? Who hates the Kurds? The Turks, the Syrians, the Iraqis, and the Iranians, and maybe there's a few others. A lot of people hate the Kurds for some reason. Why? Are they Muslim? Yes, they are Muslim, okay? But they don't like them for whatever Middle East reasons they have, right? So I was with this Kurdish activist in Washington. We were both lobbying. He was lobbying for Israel. If I was lobbying for Israel, he was lobbying for Kurdistan. I said to him, dude, what is your problem? You can make peace in a second. Just give parts of your land to Iran or to Turkey and you'll make peace with them. And then we laughed at how absurd it was. Ha ha ha, that's so dumb. How could you possibly believe that if you give a piece of your land to Iran, there's going to be peace? That's just stupid. Nobody in the Middle East actually believes that. No Middle Eastern type person. Okay? It's just silly. Of course, we and the Kurds have a related status. You know what our related status is? We are an armed ethnic minority. If you remember anything from this session today, I want you to remember this. Israel is an armed ethnic minority. That's what we are. We're Jewish. That's a peoplehood, an ethnicity. We're a group living in a tiny piece of land. We're armed. We're an ethnic minority in a much, much bigger region. A much bigger region that stems all the way from the western part of North Africa all the way to Iran. It's a humongous landmass, okay? We are a tiny little tribe defending ourselves. That's all we are. And what do you do when you're a tiny tribe defending yourself? You make sure that people don't kill your people, don't rape your people. Don't do bad things to your people. You hold on to your land. You push back on bad guys. That's the solution. It's so simple. Hold on to your land. Don't let other tribes infiltrate and take over. Don't give them huge advantages because the point of the state of Israel is to give advantage to our people. That's the point. To help you become that doctor and become a doctor at Hadassah and Karma. And not Ahmed. God bless him. God bless Ahmed. But he's got 22 countries. And if he really loves Israel, sure, he could stay and make a life here. But this is not the point of the Jewish state of Zionism, was to empower the Arabs. The Arabs, God bless them. I always tell Arabs, Allah loves you. He's given you 22 countries, oil coming out of the ground. How many Arabs are there today in the world? Arabs, not Muslims. Do you know how many? What's your guess? Shh. That's true. How much would you guess? How many Jews are there in the world? Do you know?
13.
Okay, 13, 14. Good. How many are in Israel? Around half, that's right, 7 million, you're right. And how many Arabs do you think are in our region here? Throw out a number, doesn't matter. Believe me, it's fine.
In Israel or in the Middle East?
In the Middle East, in our neighbors here.
Like 17?
The answer is 400 million. There are 400 million Arabs. It's all good. 400 million Arabs surrounding us in 22 countries. And I didn't even say Muslims, because remember, Iran, they're not Arabs. Turkey, they're not Arabs. Okay, and there's also Black Africa, which is Muslim, but not Arabs. Okay, so we are a tiny little people of 7 million, surrounded by 400 million of not our people. I'm not saying they're all our enemies. I am not saying that. But I am saying that we are surrounded. Therefore, we're an armed ethnic minority trying to keep our country safe. Okay, Obviously, all this is predicated on other stuff, which I would have talked about if I would have given my other talk, which is what is Israel predicated upon, which is predicated upon the Bible, the history of the Jewish people, the indigeneity of our peoplehood in the Bible, as proved by archaeology, and as proved by the fact that our peoplehood still exists and still carries these things. It's predicated on a nationalism, the right of ancestral peoples to live on their ancestral homeland, which is, by the way, the beautiful thing that happened at the end of World War I, which nations got to rule their land. We get to rule our land after World War I, just like many other nations were freed from the yoke of the Turkish Empire and other empires. We get to live in our land, and our land was recognized as ours. And the last thing is defense. Defense. The Jewish people have a right to defend themselves, and we must defend ourselves. Nobody's going to do it for us, including not President Biden or any international gathering. Nobody is going to defend us. Nobody's going to defend us. We have to defend ourselves. That's what never again means. It means never again shall we rely on others to defend ourselves. So Hebron happens to be a place that is the oldest Jewish community in the world, 3,500 years old. First property of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. Abraham purchased a plot of land there 3,800 years ago, buried his beloved wife Sarah. It's a love story. Okay? King David ruled there for 7 years before he moves to Jerusalem. We have found from the Hezekiah period, a little bit like 100 years after David, we have found seals that say Lemelech Hebron. What language did we find that in? Akkadian? Aramaic? Arabic? What language? Plain old Hebrew. Any kid could read it. Actually, the alphabet is different. That's true, though. But in any case, we have found remnants of our peoplehood in this land. We are from here. We are not foreigners. We are not occupiers. We are the ancestral tribe that lived in this land. By the way, one little thing is, one of the things that I disagree with, are you okay? You all right? Everything's okay? Okay. So one of the things that I think we should always be saying about Israel is, Israel, the third commonwealth. The third commonwealth. That's my recommendation to you. Write that down in your notes. The third commonwealth. That's what I recommend. I recommend we say, Eidan HaBayit HaShlishi, or whatever you want to call it, or how do you want to say third commonwealth? Eich nagid is Eidan HaRibonut HaShlishit, whatever you want to call it. Third commonwealth of the Jewish people. This is not our first rodeo. We did not get born here in 1948. The UN did not give birth to Israel. There's no greater lie in the world than the idea that the UN somehow gave birth to Israel. We were a nation in this land way before those other countries were even an idea. It's a joke. It's just a joke. This is our third time. This is our third time Jerusalem is the capital. And everybody should know that. Because if they don't know it, then you tell this American high school Jewish kid, you tell him, yeah, Israel's occupying Hebron. Are you joking me? Is that a joke? Occupying Hebron. We were in Hebron for 1,400 years before Islam was an invention. Okay? What a joke. What a joke. The Jewish people are white colonialists. Did you read the book of Esther? We're from frickin' Persia. Okay, our forefather was Abraham, was from Iraq. We are from this area. We're from this land. We have walked this land. We have archaeology. You scratch the surface, there is no Palestine. There is no Palestine. You scratch the surface, you're going to find layers and layers of Jewish life here in all the different eras. And now they're telling us that we're white colonialists? What a joke. And do you know why they tell us we're white colonialists? Do you know why? Because we act like it. We act like white colonialists. When you walk out of your land, when you talk about I'm willing to divide Jerusalem, when you make all these kind of deals, when you walk out of Gaza, you're signaling, I don't really care. I don't really belong here. You're right. It's your land. And that sends a signal that we're thieves. And that's what they believe on American campuses today. That we're thieves. That we're white colonialists. So, there's been a failure in how we present these things and a failure in how we defend these things. And I hope to God that your generation, I hope that even, you know, my generation still will start to rectify this stuff, and certainly your generation will start to getting back to a healthy Middle Eastern Jewish biblical attitudes that will keep us safe and make this whole region flourish. Thank you very much. Okay. Take this. Now I specifically cut my talking short so that I can discuss with you what you guys think and your issues. And I see there's already questions. Ladies first. What's your name and where are you from?
Keren Ashdod.
Mama, Keren? Yofi, Keren Ashdod. I like Ashdod, but I like Ashkelon better. Okay, that's just me. I just love Ashkelon. I love Ashkelon. I can't help it. I just love it. My mom is in an apartment there. I love it. Yeah.
So, like, you were speaking about
חתן המכון שהקוני בדבר. עוד פעם, המטרה היא?
המטרה של חמאס היא לצמצם את האוכלוסייה הישראלית ולצמצם את השטח שאנחנו נמצאים.
לצמצם?
כאילו להקטין.
שמעת ממני שאני רוצה לצמצם? שחמאס רוצים לצמצם. כן. הם רוצים לצמצם, נכון. יופי, אוקיי. Sorry, almost had a heart attack. I'm like, I must have been misunderstood. No. חמאס רוצים לצמצם עד הסוף. כן, עד הסוף. בהתחלה בצמצום, אחרי זה עד קלוט, כן.
בפועל מה שקורה זה שבגדה הערבית, השטח של פלסטינים הולך וגדל בעצם שנים
האחרונות.
השטח של
נוכחות ישראלית
גדל וגדל. זאת אומרת, בפועל אנחנו
מרחיבים
את השטח שלנו פה ולפלסטינים, יש פחות
מפחות
מקום פה.
את יודעת שאני איש ימין, כן? אני לא מאמין בכלל שיש להם שום שטח, אני לא מאמין בזכות שלהם על השטח הזאת, אני לא מאמין שיש כזה דבר פלסטין, אני חושב שהכל שקר וכזב, אין להם שום זכות היסטורית על הסיפור הזה, כל קשקוש בלבוש. אז אני לא חושב, אני חושב שרק אנחנו לא מכילים את הריבונות שלנו על האדמה שלנו. הם דווקא מתפרסים בכל מקום, ועכשיו אני מדבר לא מן הירת, אלא מהידע איפה שאני מסתובב, ואני רואה אותם מתפרסים על כל הגבעות, תופסים שטח שהוא גם שטח של קקל, ובכל אופן הוא שטח של מדינת ישראל. יהודה ושמרון זה הלב ההיסטורי של עם ישראל. פלסטינים זה עם שהתיישב פה עם הדורות בכל מיני דברים, לא הייתה להם שום מדינה ריבונית פה, שום דבר אחר, והם כמו אורחים פה, ואם הם רוצים לחיות בשלום, אהלן וסהלן. זה לא הארץ שלהם וזה לא האדמה שלהם, לפי ההסתכלות שלי כמובן. אוקיי? Yes. What's your name? Where are you from?
I'm Jack. I'm from LA.
Jack from LA?
Yeah.
What are you, Syrian? What are you?
Not Syrian.
No? Okay.
Never got that before.
Syrians are called Jack a lot of times, yeah.
Okay. First off,
they have a lot of like Jacks. They have a lot of like, yeah.
First off, thank you. I like it a lot.
Thank you very much.
You mentioned the future of Israel with like peace deals and like trying to have strong Jewish land and a strong Arab land, right? And then you mentioned the Saudi Arabia deal, which I'm very like...
There's no deal, but a potential Abraham continuation of Abraham Accords, yeah.
And while that was very much on the table on October 6th, and it still is right now, except the change in the deal is that now the Saudis have said, and other Arab countries have said, that they want a Palestinian state in order for a peace deal.
Yeah.
So then how are we supposed to, let's say, achieve these peace deals if that's like their one now request?
Have you ever haggled in the market around here? Have you ever been a Middle Easterner? Have you ever haggled? The other guy says, yeah. Well, let me ask you this. Let's go back a few steps. These are great questions. Let me ask you this. Why do the Saudis want peace with Israel? Why? Do they start reading Rav Kook? What happened? They believe in the writings of Herzl Makara. Why do they want peace with Israel?
Economic reasons.
That's not the first reason. There's a lot of words. The first reason is defense. Not defense deal with America. They need defense. From whom? Iran. Not Iran. Okay? Iran. Okay? Okay? Iran. They want defense from Iran. Why?
Because Iran is the Shia of
Israel. Right. Okay. And who is a better fighter? The Iranians or the Saudis?
Probably Iran.
The Iranians are cream Saudi Arabia. Like this. Okay? Saudi Arabia have not even been able to deal with their own Houthi problem and all that, although the Houthis are a formidable enemy. But in any case, the bottom line is that they look to see. Now this guy, what's his name? MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, he is looking around and he's thinking to himself, first thing, I want to defend my country. Second thing, I know that the oil is going to run out. So I want to make some smart economics right now, like my neighbors in the UAE, do some smart stuff. He looks around the region, who's going to be his partner, right? Now he could say, okay, no women drivers, we're going to do Wahhabism and jihadism. It's like, how far is that going to take you, bro? How far is that going to take you? The oil's going to run out. You're not a good fighter. The other jihadis are better jihadis than you are. They're going to wash over you. So he thinks to himself, I need to kind of modernize, okay? So he looks and he sees a strong Israel. He says, woof, that is a strong country. They know how to fight back on the jihad. Now the jihad is more dangerous to him than it is to Israel, right? The jihad, they always want to take him off because they think that he's a fraud. The Saud, House of Saud took over the holy places. The ISIS, they want to get rid of him. About 8 months ago, they captured about 82 ISIS folks. And on a Friday, they beheaded them, 82 of them, or 83, in Riyadh, in the big square, okay? He understands he's got a jihad problem. He looked to Israel. He's like, Israel, you're strong. Good. We can do economics. Good. You can help defend me. You can help defend me from a nuclear... Iran is a nuclear Israel, maybe. Okay? You'll defend it. Okay. Now, when we are weak, when he sees that the jihadis right next door know how to crush us, he thinks to himself, these guys are not as strong as I was hoping. I'm not as excited to make a deal because there's going to be political costs, but the Israelis are not as strong as I would have liked. Okay, they're a little bit weaker, all right? The Hamas, what do they want to do? They wanted to derail this peace with Saudi Arabia because it would have legitimized Israel in the Muslim world. So they did everything October 6th to stop. That's one of the reasons why they wanted to attack, because they wanted to stop that Saudi-Israeli deal. Okay, now let me ask you this. Does it make sense to you that another part of this deal would be that we also cut up another piece of land and hand it over to the jihad, a Palestine, like Karen wants, let's say, okay? It's like, do you think it's a good idea? Do you think it's a good idea for us to like weaken ourselves even more and show the Saudis, yeah, here, we're going to make a Palestine in our land so the jihadis, because like they took over Gaza, they'll take over the West Bank, squeezing Jerusalem like this, shooting down on Tel Aviv. So the Saudis say these things, and you know what you're supposed to say? Hell no. That's what you say to them. You want peace with me? I'm one of the richest countries, the strongest countries in the region. You want a nuclear defense pact? You got it. Don't tell me to give up my land. You talk like that, I walk out. And when you talk like that, then there's something which Israelis have no clue about. I'm going to say a word which is very, very tricky. It's going to be hard for Israelis to understand this word. It's respect. You get a little respect around here. You respect, you push back at the bad guys. They tell you, let's divide Jerusalem. You say, if you say that word one more time, I never want to speak to you again. Don't talk to me about Yerushalayim. Don't talk to me about Yerushalayim. Well, after you did to me what you did in Gaza, we wiped you guys out like this. That's who we are around here. We're Majnun. We're crazy. You don't mess with us. Okay? And then people are like, oh, that's a Middle East country. That's Israel. They're strong, like we respect. But instead, we're wishy-washy. We're like Woody Allen all the time. Take this land. Here you go. Okay, Palestine, here's my homeland. Doesn't matter. Jerusalem, whatever you want. You look like a ninny around here, okay? You look like a ninny. You look so weak. And so if you want to talk with the Saudis, talk with them in Saudi Arabia, not in south of France. Talk like a Middle Easterner.
Can I ask a follow-up on that?
Quick follow-up.
So you're saying that we have to be like a Middle Eastern, and that makes sense to me, but also at the same time, the countries that have succeeded throughout history are Western countries, and if Israel wants to act more like a Western country, then maybe they'll also get more success. Because the Western countries are known to have succeeded, while Middle Eastern countries have often times not succeeded.
Jack, that is a very good question. I appreciate that. And I'll answer you straight. You're right. There are elements of our country that are Western, and I'm not embarrassed about that. Western economics, free market economics, not centrally controlled economics. Western liberalism in the sense of individual freedom and individual rights. I accept that. Democracy, to a limited extent, is a good thing. It's got to be within borders that are not dumb, that you don't let bad people take over your country. But I agree with you. What I was talking about is defense. I wasn't talking about that we should be now, you know, everything Saudi Arabia is. I'm not saying that. Although it would be nice to be a little slimmer, a little bit more religious, okay? It would be nice if we had a little bit more respect for our holy places and not let people trample them and do whatever they want. Yeah, but you're right. There are aspects of Israel that people like myself respect as being, let's call it Western. There are elements of that. But when it comes to defense, no. When you're dealing with the other guy, you got to meet him not in a Western way. By the way, the West, when dealing with bad guys, used to know that you don't like go all liberal on them. You go hard on them. That's what they did in Japan. That's what they did with Germany. That's what they did when there was a war and somebody was attacking you. You took care of business. Today, they've become fuddy-duddy. And thereby also weak. Yes, sir. Oh, there's people on this side also. Go. Kenachi. The bear. Huh? Ma ken lasot itam?
Lo me'ad Palestinians b'medina.
Ken.
Ma atza shelcha le'achshav kilo im ata lo dam. Achshav rosh hamshala.
Ken ivanti otcha. Ma atza. Okay. Shela tova. Ma hashem aval?
Ido
me'ashkelon. Yeah, baby. Love Ashkelon. Love Ashkelon. I love that Ashkelon Park. Do you ever go to Park Ashkelon in the south? I love that place. That's my beach. Baruch Hashem is my favorite. Ma, Zikim? Ma, Taberti. So Ido asks, who was Ido, by the way? What's this name, Ido? Where is that from?
Isha Elohim.
Nachon. Solid. So Ido asks, a very fairly, okay, so Yishai, so you give a whole spiel where what to do with the Palestinians, what to do with them. Again, Ido, to be honest with you, it's actually not so complex. It's really not so complex. I believe that the concept of resident alien, residency, dehainu ma shenikra b'Torah, ger toshav. We had this concept 3,500 years ago, ger toshav. Toshav, resident, ger, alien. Resident alien, people that live in your land, that means they're from other tribes. This is the tribal land of the Jews. We have a system to defend ourselves and to help each other grow. Other minorities want to come live here. Ahlan wasahlan. You have to respect my country, respect my flag, respect my peoplehood. If you act outside of that, you lose your rights and privileges. If you want to live in that, get residency. Get residency, you get to live here, get to work here, get to fly in Israeli passports, fine. But voting about it is a little bit different. Wait, let me ask you a question, Ido. Before I go on about voting, how many Arab countries have democratic voting? Out of the 22? Their own countries.
Zero.
Huh? Ephes. Okay? This much. Okay? So they have zero democratic voting in their own country. That means that that's not a natural system to them. It's not a natural system. Therefore, I'm not going to come here out of the ashes of the Holocaust, Mia Shoah, to now bequeath voting rights in the Arabs. That's not what I'm here to do. Not what I'm here to do. I'm here to defend my peoplehood. So, Toda Rabah. Thank you. Appreciate it. So, what to do with the Arabs? Residency for Arabs living in our land, with rights and privileges for everybody who follows the law. Anybody who doesn't, anybody who speaks, thinks, puts a Facebook post of jihad, is out of here. He does not have a right to live in our land and to threaten us. Okay? Now, what about democratic rights? Okay. So, you cannot live here if you're a criminal who hates this peoplehood. You have to go. You have to get pushed out. You're going to have to find different places. You can go today, there's many countries that are willing to welcome refugees. Scotland said they would, and Australia said they would, and Belgium said they would, and we know that many other countries take them in. But certainly the Arab countries have to be forced to take their brothers in, because we're not going to accept people in our land that hate us. We're not going to accept people in our land that hate us. And by the way, Ido, look how hard it is to accept such a simple premise. It's a kukach pashut. People who want to destroy your country from within should not be here. Lo kashe. Right? Simple. That's what a proud Jewish state would be like. Now, what about other options? I wrote an article, it's in the New York Times, A Settler's Vision for the Future of Israel, 2017, February, you could look it up, and it lists five alternatives to the two-state solution, five alternatives, including one that, I'm going to surprise you, there is a Palestine. Echamano, Keren, Psorot Madimot. Yesh Palestine kvar, hikayemet. היא קיימת, כן, יש כבר שני מדינות לשני עמים, המדינה הזאת קוראים לה ירדן, אוקיי? היא על ידינו, היא המדינה ששם גרים 80% פלסטינים, היא מדינה שנלקחה משטח שהוא היה אמור להיות ישראל, דהיינו, אנחנו כבר נתנו, שחררנו, לא יודע מה, בקיצור, יש כבר מדינה פלסטינית, נאה, קוראים לה ירדן, הכל בסדר. עכשיו, אני לא אומר שצריך להעיף את כולם לירדן. I'm not saying you have to kick everybody to Jordan. I say, you want citizenship? You want to be like a full-fledged voting? They don't have voting, but whatever. You want to be... Go ahead, you can have your citizenship in Jordan, a Palestinian state, and stay here as resident, as long as you follow the law, as long as you respect our country. Don't try to take over. Don't bully our women. Don't write posts about jihad. Don't do these things. You do. You're going to have to go to the real Palestine, which is Jordan or somewhere else, and you have to accept the fact that this is a Jewish state. That's all. Say it proud, and people will respect you. Yes. מה השם ומאיפה?
תוהר מתקומה.
תוהר מתקומה.
כן. אתה חושב שהשיח השתנה בעקבות השביעי לאוקטובר?
את תגידי לי, מה את חושבת?
מה אני חושבת? אני חושבת שפשוט...
She asked whether if the conversation has changed post October 7th. I'm asking her what she thinks.
אני חושבת שהמון אנשים נפגשים באמצע, במצב של... דיברת על זה עם אבא שלי לפני שבועיים, שאמרתי לו שכאילו, הייתי רוצה לחיות כאן בשלום, ואז אמר לי, אוקיי, אז מה את עושה כאילו עם כל מי שלא רוצה לחיות איתך בשלום? והייתי כזה, לא יודעת, ואז אמר לי, אז מה הפתרון? אני חושבת שהמון אנשים יוצאים במצב שאין פתרון לדבר הזה, אז...
כן. אז טוב, בוא נגיד לך משהו. So she says... She says that she spoke with her father, and he said, well, what are you going to do with all the haters or the antis? And she said, I don't know. And he says, well, what's the solution? And they got stuck in the situation. Tar, I got to say something to you. The other side They know what they're doing. While you and your father, God bless, are trying to figure it out, the other side is 100% sure what to do, which is to continue to take over the land, continue to take over the Yehuda v'Shomron, continue to take over Gaza, continue to arm themselves in Lebanon, continue to take over the bus. All the busing in Israel is now Arab drivers. The Beit Cholim, the what do you call it? First response rooms. Terem. All the terems. I took my son to a terem. It was like all Arabs. It was not very comfortable, frankly. I'll be honest with you. And I don't have a problem with Arabs, but like it was not comfortable for me. You know, I don't have a problem with Arabs. I don't have a cultural. I feel close with Arabs. That's one of the things that a lot of times people don't understand. Do you think the right wingers don't like Arabs? The opposite. I'm like an Arab. I'm like them. Better. I don't have an ethnic problem. The opposite. It's because I'm like them. I understand how they think. I don't have a problem with their way. I just understand that they're trying to push into my society, and I got to push them back. I respect the fact that this is their region. I respect.
So we should do the same.
We should push them out, the ones that hate us. Yeah, absolutely. I respect that. I respect that they understand the rules of the Middle East, and I don't respect people who act like white colonialists who think you can just negotiate everything and just give them a little bit of land and appease them. I think that that's dumb, and you don't understand the ways of this region, those kind of people. And so, yeah, I think that they're childish and have led to tragedy here, have led to giving away Gaza was an example of total idiocy, and which basically that land became filled. The Arabs were subjugated there. The jihad took over, the kids were brainwashed, the tunnels were built, the attack came, and they're still doing it. So yeah, I think that that's dumb. Bottom line is, the other side, they are sure what to do. Okay? So what we have to do is a little bit more sure. This is our piece of land. You got to defend it. Don't let the bad guys in. Don't let them take over your land. Pashut. Kegandui.
I'm in the line from your favorite city in the world, Ashkelon.
Yeah. What are you guys, all Ashkelon here? What's going on? Hi,
Itamar.
Some of the best people are named Itamar.
My question is...
yeah, go ahead.
I understand that it is like our... like we were there and all of that, but what's the sense of holding a couple of Jewish settlements surrounded by a hostile Arab society?
Yeah, don't let them be hostile. That's the answer.
So why not evacuate them and then give them Gaza and
stay in Israel? How did that work? You tell me now. Itamar, come on. You're a hard man. You're a smart kid. Just tell me, did that work out good or not?
Again,
I asked you a question. Answer me. Yes or no? Did it work out? You threw out a solution. Does it work or not? You threw out these... Why not?
It didn't work, but we should do it better.
Oh.
The Prime Minister should have a bigger job in holding them. But originally, it's not the best idea to hold a Jewish settlement in Arab, like, hostile...
Israel is a Jewish settlement in an Arab hostile area. Israel is a Jewish settlement in a hostile Arab area. Tzemize, you can't walk away from your land and you can't always be... It's such a ghetto thinking, ghetto. Well, let me go back. They don't like me. Go back. I'll live in my little Tel Aviv ghetto and everything will be okay, I hope. Die. Be big. I have a statement. Go big and go home. Okay? Go big. Be big. Be chazak. Push back and back, guys. That's the only way to make it around here.
But I just think that we should give them, we say borders inside of Israel right now,
we don't need it. You don't need it. I need it. Because first thing, it's our ancestral land. And second thing is because we grow things there. And our children grow there. And it's the best beaches. And it's our land. And it gives us more defense. The bigger we are in our land, the bigger we are in our land, not their lands. Nobody's talking about taking over Egypt. Egypt is Egypt. The bigger, by the way, is there a good map of Israel around here? I wish I would have brought it, but I've been so busy. If you would open up a map, it's so obvious what the borders of Israel are. You know, natural borders. The natural borders of Israel are from the Suez, including the Sinai, until the Jordan Valley, up to the mountains of Lebanon. That's the small, tiny Israel. That's the natural borders. You can't defend it. And Itamar, for God's sakes, how could you now, in this after October 7th, throw out like, yeah, you know, let's not have little settlements, walk out of there. We did that. That's exactly what we did. We did that to the best in realistic terms that could be done. And it was an abysmal, an awful failure. As bo nachlif disk.
I don't אז אפשר להחליף דיס ולהגיד שאנחנו נכניס לגז על מישהו שבאמת יתפקד ויעשה שם עבודה, ולא רק נעזור ונעשה משהו.
נכון, צריך להישאר שם ולעשות עבודה.
צריך להיות שלנו, אבל אנחנו לא יכולים להמשיך שפשוט להחזיק איזה...
התשובה היא מאוד פשוטה, תפסיקו להיות חנונים. זה התשובה, זה התשובה הפשוטה. Yes, sir.
I'm Jeremy from Chicago.
Okay. Where from? Rogers Park?
No, Dearborn.
Is that not a big air barrier also? Oh, that's Dearborn, Michigan.
Yeah.
not so far away. Yeah, not so far, yeah.
You mentioned how the land
Deerfield.
Swap in Gaza was a complete failure, but when we look at the
land swap?
Not swap, sorry. The land...
giveaway. Land yeah. Not back. Not back, because there was never a Hamas-Palestine beforehand. We gave it away and created, helped create that. Let's use terms properly, okay? That way we know what we're talking about.
To the giving land for the Sinai Peninsula,
oh.
Which did lead to peace. Oh. How do you see that as a different...
Wait, I forgot your first name, because I...
Jeremy,
right, okay. Jeremy, you hit my landmine, okay? Okay? You hit my landmine. Okay. I try not to go into this because I see that people, it's hard for people to understand it. The biggest sin that Israel ever did was the Sinai giveaway. That was the beginning of the biggest mistake that we're living with today. Sinai to Sadat, who was very quickly murdered. Let me ask you this. Does Sinai belong to Egypt historically? The answer is no. Go to the Bible. Remember, when you leave Egypt, you go to the Sinai because they're two separate things. Did you look at the map? Sinai and Egypt are connected by this, okay? The people that live in the Sinai, who lives there? Egyptians? No, Bedouins live there. Do they like the Egyptians? No, they hate each other. Hate. Bedouins hate the Egyptians, okay? The Sinai is not Egypt. That's just the first thing. Second thing is, Israel was a big, badass Jewish state with the Sinai. With oil fields, with airfields, with controls of two sea lanes of the Red Sea. The port of the Gulf of Suez and the Gulf of Aqaba, okay? Like this, we controlled, we were big, badass, had a big country. You don't mess with us, okay? And that's what happens when you mess with us. We hold on to this land, which is our land anyway, but we hold on to it nice and big and good. Then Begin came. And Begin, he wanted to be a country that looked good, seemed moral, was peaceful, was willing to do everything for peace. Peace, 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 peace. I read when I see his writings about peace, I start to like want to puke. I'm like, dude, the way you have peace around here is when you're strong. We gave away the Sinai. Egypt never became pro-Israel. It's one of the most anti-Israel countries. They teach the most amount. The number one selling book there is still Protocols of the Elders of Zion and Mein Kampf. That's on the streets of Egypt. The Sinai became filled with a passageway for arms and other things that ended up in the hands of Hamas, including another thing, which is African migrants and other things that all come through the Sinai. Okay? The Gaza is always fed through the Sinai. And then we already gave the idea that we are going to kick out Jews from their homes, shrink our country because we're going to be a good country, not a strong country. Okay? And it was the biggest failure that led to this way of thinking. Since the 1982 Sinai Accords with Egypt, we have only become weaker and weaker and weaker. We haven't won a war since the Six-Day War. Okay? We haven't won one war. We have shrunken in size. Our economy has grown, our people has grown, Baruch Hashem. But in terms of the country's, you know, size and defenses, we're shrinking like this all the time. And we already, and Begin already came up with the idea of the autonomy in Judea and Samaria, i.e. the creation of a Palestine down the line in our ancestral homeland. So to me, people like me think that Sinai was the first and biggest mistake. We didn't really make peace with Egypt. It wasn't a real peace with Egypt. With the UAE and Abraham Accords, we have started to make real peace. We didn't give them anything. We didn't give away any land. We didn't do anything. We just said, listen, we have economic and defense pacts that could get together. Sinai was a tragedy. It was a nightmare. It was what's called in Christian original sin. That's the original sin. The original sin was Begin's. After that, we kept sinning and sinning and sinning. Oslo Accords, disengagement, '93, Oslo Accords, 2005, disengagement. It's all part of the same horrible mistake of weakness. Yes?
I'm Molly from Chicago.
All right. You guys know each other from Chicago? Okay, cool.
So I understand what you're saying about like not giving up more land and.
Come on, Nisha, no, Vuksha.
And also.
Start asking some hard questions. Let's go. Come on. Just joking. Come on. Yeah.
I also agree that giving up more land is not necessarily the right answer. But I do really think that just, like, forcing people out of the land that they also live here now.
Only forcing bad guys out. Haters. Not regular people. People who hate you. People who want to destroy you. It's a tribal region. I'm not saying kick out people. I'm saying people who hate you.
And not letting them vote. And
what does vote mean? What does vote mean? We have a system that we created for our peoplehood in order to run this country. This is a Jewish state. You want to create votes? There's many different ways. I'll give you an example. Puerto Rico. You know Puerto Rico? Is it a state or not a state? Not a state. Are the people living there citizens?
Yes.
Yes, they are. Do they have a right to vote for American president?
No,
they do not. Well, like, what happened? Well, because it's a territory, it's being administered differently. Do they? Here's a tricky one. Do they vote for congressmen and senators?
Yes.
Yes, they do. They don't vote. That's right. Very good. Okay, but that's right. So they have congressmen and senators, but they are non-voting, i.e. they come there to Congress, say their thing, talk about their problems, which is what a congressman or a senator is supposed to do, but they don't have a right to vote because that territory doesn't have the right to vote. That's America. That's America. And how dangerous are Puerto Ricans? They're not. Okay, there's 2 million Puerto Ricans. They're not dangerous at all. But they've decided that this region has a different specialized democracy situation for whatever reason. I say people who are dangerous to us shouldn't exactly decide where our country is going. By the way, the Knesset members that we have, the Arab Knesset members, some of them are vile anti-Semites, vile anti-Israel folks, like terrorists. Azmi Bouchara, remember him? He had to run away because we caught him, you know, being promoting terrorism. He was a Knesset member. And there's more and more and more. Bleasov. The Knesset members are some of the worst. So they sit on our committees. They get our intelligence. So I say, don't be dumb. You want them to vote? You tell me that we can have municipal elections, that they can vote their own judges, their own people. They can have their own thing in their regions. Fine. You want them to have Knesset members? Fine, but let them be non-voting Knesset members. Or say there's a certain amount. The Arab population can have 3 Knesset members to make sure that people hear their problems. But let's be smart and defend ourselves.
But do you really think that by minimizing them and I think in theory, like, having Israel as the Jewish state, like, I agree. I don't see how after all these years we can, like, continue to, like, put them down like that and expect to, like, have peace.
Molly, everything that we do to give them more opportunities blows up in our face. You have to at some point see the truth. They take the thing that you give them, the inch, and they want a mile. They do not. Nothing that you do ameliorates them. There's nothing you can do to appease them. They have a different... We have an ethnic conflict. We have an ethnic religious conflict. This is not about rights. They don't want more rights. They don't want more land. They have an ethnic religious conflict against us. It is against Islam to have a Jewish state in the middle of their land because of 2 reasons. 1, Judaism is supposed to be replaced by Islam. And 2 is that any lands that was once Islamic, which this land was, cannot become the land of somebody else. You have to liberate it. That's called Dar el-Kharb. You're not allowed to give up land. So therefore, you have to accept this, Molly. You have to accept this. It's an ethnic religious conflict. And it's not going to be mollified by all kinds of ways to appease them. Just won't happen. Ken. Maza? Yes, there's a lot of folks. Go.
Karen from Manhattan.
Where at?
West 60s.
Nice. So you're in the lower Upper West Side?
Yeah, fake upper
at, what do you call it, at Lincoln Center.
Yeah, my South and Rabbi Riskin actually.
Oh, cool. That's right. I lived on the upper West Side. 189th in Amsterdam, yeah.
Nice. I like Amsterdam. How do you expect American college students to go back, like with your ideology, to go back to...
Wait, what was your first name again, though?
Karen.
Oh, another Karen. Okay. Karen. Yeah. No problem.
Birthday.
Really? That's cute. Yeah.
How do you expect us to, like, with your ideology, to go back to college campuses and prove that Jews aren't trying to commit genocide?
That is the dumbest thing I ever heard.
No, because, like,
where are we? How are we committing a genocide? Because they want to make you look bad. They want to darken your whole. They want to make your country look like a. Okay, you know what, Karen? I'll give you a better answer, okay?
Yeah.
I take back everything.
No,
Karen, check this out.
It was a...
Karen, listen to me. In the Middle Ages, and all the way up to the 1900s, there was this thing called the blood libel. The blood libel was a way for Christians at the time, and also Muslims, but mostly Christians, to say that Jews are bad. Here's what they do to our babies. They shecht our, they slaughter our babies, they use them for matzah. What's happening today is a modern blood libel. It's a modern day blood libel. Are we murdering, are we doing ethnic cleansing or genocide on the Arabs?
I don't think we are.
Okay, so you're the folks on campus are, they have what's called a weaponized narrative. They've weaponized the narrative. They have a narrative that Israel is bad. Now Israel, everything Israel does is bad. And we've actually, we've in many ways allowed that weaponized narrative to metastasize. Yeah. Nothing that I say now, nothing against you out there on campus. The only thing that you could do is, A, hang out with good people who don't hate Israel. B, if somebody's in your face, you know, if you can't push them back, either ignore them or do not deal with them. Or if somebody's like, you know, in your face, then you got to know how to beat them back up so that they don't beat you up. Okay? And basically, we have to fight a narrative that our country is allowed to metastasize. But basically, it doesn't matter what my ideology is. Because again, as I was telling Molly, it doesn't make any difference. Because no matter if you say to them, no, we want to be... Let me tell you a story. Can I tell you a story? Who likes a story? You like a story? Here's a story. I haven't told you enough stories today. But I have so many stories and I haven't even told you any stories. Here's a story, okay? One time I was working at a radio station here and I get a phone call on my phone and it says, Qatar is calling. Who's calling me from Qatar? I don't have any girlfriends in Qatar. Who do you think is calling me from Qatar? Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera. I'm on media, okay? So Al Jazeera is calling. So I'm like, I accept the call. And of course, it's like a British accent. Hello, Mr. Fleischer. You know, we really would love it if you... It was during one of these Gaza wars. I don't remember which one even. And they go, it was after the three boys were kidnapped and murdered. And they call me into the studios. And I said, sure, I'll come down to discuss the war. So they say to me, you come down to the Technological Park here in Malha. And that's where they have studios. Fine. In the meantime, I have a reporter friend of mine. And I'm going to call him for the conversation. I'm going to call him Bill, okay? So I said to him, I go, Bill, Al Jazeera is calling me. And what do you think I should say? So Bill says to me, he says, you should tell them that we're doing our very best not to hurt the civilians. And we're like making sure that civilians aren't injured and stuff like that. And we're like doing our best to fight a moral war. I said to him, Bill, that is the dumbest thing I ever heard. He says, why? I go, because the minute I'm going to say we're trying so hard not to hurt civilians, they're going to show images of a kid being pulled out of the rubble with his hand hanging out, okay, and his eyeball hanging out, and they're going to be like, you are the biggest liar, Yishai and Israel. So he says to me, so what are you going to do? I said, watch this. I go to Al Jazeera. So I know that they have the image already waiting, you know, that video. So they go, Mr. Fleischer, you know, how is it that only 70 Israelis have been killed and almost 3,000 Palestinians? So they're ready for me to be like, well, we're trying really hard to like make sure the civilians aren't hurt, you know, try give that whole Israeli, like, we're a moral army crap narrative, okay? So instead I'm like, I said to them, yeah, that's what happens when you start with us. You mess with us, you mess one hair on one of our kids, we crush you 10 times as hard. Don't start with us, okay? That's what Israel means. We're here to defend our peoplehood. We're post-Holocaust people. Shoot one rocket, you'll get 10 in your face. They were like, and they were like, should I play that video now with the kid? They were totally stuck. And then they tried it again. Later on in the program, they go, Mr. Fleischer, how is it that I don't know, whatever, 10,000 rockets were sent in Israel and only 70 people were hurt, something like that. So I'm like, I have to take off my press hat and put on my rabbi hat. I said to him, it's min Allah. God protects the Jews. Do you think Hamas doesn't know how to shoot rockets? It's on video, all this stuff. Yeah, I said, do you think Hamas doesn't know how to shoot rockets? God, Allah swipes them away to protect the Jewish people. You are doing against the will of Allah. They were like, they were totally stuck. Instead of giving them the sissy answer that, yeah, we're really trying hard and all that, that never buys you one friend. I gave them what they respect, which is strength. Push back on their narrative. Tell them, you start with us, that's what you get. Don't mess with the Jewish state. We're Majnun. That's the way to talk with them. They respect that. Yeah, this guy wanted to ask for a while. What's your name? Where are you from?
I'm from Connecticut.
Where in Connecticut?
Westport.
Okay.
So I get the whole thing, what you're saying, of like you have to act crazy, you got to be Middle East,
you got to live in the Middle East. We're here.
Got to be strong. Just that's basically it. Yeah. Yeah.
But so how do you think that works with how we're seeing how Western countries react when we even do like a slight fraction of not even really being strong in this war, of just being like kind of even average, how like average country would react, versus if we were to be strong, we still, I'd love to see an Israel that could be fully independent, but we still need the codes for the F-35s every morning, we need replacement parts of the F-16s, we need all these things, we need the bombs, like, we do need support from other countries. How do you think other countries would react if your ideology was fully
implemented? Good question, Avi. It's a good question. Well, so let's break it down. First thing is, you said it in your question, which is, we have allowed ourselves to become very dependent. Mm-hmm. I, by the way, am not an America hater. I like America. And I have many good friends. And I think America is a great country in many ways. And I like our relationship. But it's too much. It's too much. It's too dependent. We should have other suppliers and other things, including us being the supplier. Okay? We should make stuff. We could have made our own jets, but that was quashed by the Americans. We have to be more independent. We have to have our own rockets. We have to own munitions. We have to have more of that stuff. And if you can't get it from America, get it from somebody else. The Czechs and the this and the that. There's other people who make stuff. Be cool. Don't become a puppet state. That becomes a strategic danger to Israel when we're too dependent, especially America, which one day you have a Trump and the other day you have a Biden. It's a place that things switch around. So you can't have too much dependency on that country, because when you do, you could get in trouble. That's number one.
No? So economically, would you like it to shift more towards trade
with everywhere? First thing, our trade is also with Europe, and of course with the Middle Eastern countries. Israel's global. Okay, Israel's got to be global. I'm saying America's great, but don't overdo it. Don't become too dependent on those guys. That's number one. Number two is that, I say this with respect to the United States, Obama-Biden, that way of thinking, are antithetical to Israel. They want to shrink Israel and make it weak. That's what they want. That's what Obama wanted. That's what Biden wants. I think Biden wants a weak Israel. And he wants a Palestine in their ancestral homeland. And he's got an affinity to Iran. He helped get billions of dollars over to them. And so he is not a friend to Israel, in my understanding. Okay?
Trump also attempted peace plans.
No, I'm talking to you about now. Trump tried to shut down Iran and the nuclear bomb. And the Trump peace plan was a Jewish invention, but let's talk about that later. The bottom line is you asked me, how do other countries respond? So first thing I say, I agree with you. That's why I don't build such a dependence on them. Two, I want to say something to you that's different than what I said before, which is like this. I have a lot of friends in Congress, okay? And I have a lot of friends who work in Congress, okay? Now, do you know what congressmen on the Republican side have been saying to me and my friends? They're like, you guys, why are you not standing up to Biden? If you would stand up to him, we could support you. Why are you being so quiet? Say no. Say like, no, this is unacceptable, what you're pushing on us. And by the way, Netanyahu has started basically saying that. But they're like, hey, like Biden sanctioned four Israelis that like are basically have no criminal record and are like just settler kids out there. I know some of them, you know, like and that's such an abrogation of our sovereignty. We let that slide. The Americans are saying to us, fight and we'll back you up. Show them that this president is anti-Israel and we'll support you. And say, look, this president is anti-Israel. There are millions of Americans who are pro-Israel for real, i.e. pro-strong Israel, not pro-weak Israel. So A, diversify your portfolio. And B, again, comes back to be strong and people will respect you. Your allies will stand up for you. Ken. Okay, well, sorry, you know what, this gentleman... Two. Let me have these two guys, okay? But let's do it fast. You go first, because you're taller. Let's go. Just go.
I'm Tom. I'm from Berlin. I just wanted to clarify.
Accent is not a Berlinian accent, exactly.
Yeah, I was born in the States and went to like a school with a lot of Americans.
Okay. But your parents are Germans?
No. Father's Swiss, mom is Israeli.
Oh, but your father speaks German?
Yep.
Okay.
I just wanted to ask, you mentioned the...
Sorry, I'm interested in these things. These are sociology is interesting to me. Yeah.
You mentioned the Puerto Rico model, if I understood correctly, is something which might be able to apply here.
It was more of an example, just to clarify, it was more of an example that even the great democracy of the United States has different settings when it needs to.
Yeah, you would support some kind of localized, non-threatening autonomy, theoretically.
Not autonomy, but local rule.
Self-rule. So how
local rule.
How does that contradict with, for example, the Begin peace plan, or the Begin autonomy plan, because I'm not familiar with the details, and what makes you object to Begin's plan that supports some kind of self-rule?
I'm not for Palestinianism, and I'm not for too much. I'm not for, when I say self-rule is like this, let's say you have a big Arab town like Abu Ghosh. A lot of Arabs that are pro-Israel. Okay, you want to have your own mayor. You want to have your own system? So have your own. I have no problem with that, as long as you guys are pro-Israel. So I wouldn't overly use the big words of autonomy and all that. I'm not for anybody else's sovereignty or autonomy in my ancestral homeland. Okay? I am for, if you're pro-Israel, but you have your own way of doing things, because you have a different culture, and you, let's say you're Druze. You have your own religion, you have your own Qadi or whatever it is, whatever, you know, kind of system going on. I just can respect that. I don't have to be in your kishkes. If you have a different way, but as long as you are non-jihadist and you respect our law, and if our law and our law beats your law, if there's a problem, if there's a conflict between your law and the state of Israel law, the state of Israel law trumps. But in simple terms, respect our country and we will respect your way. I got no problem with minorities living in my land. I don't need everybody to be, it's not some kind of ethnic purity that we're looking for here. I have no problem. But you have to respect, you have to be a good ger toshav, a good resident alien, okay? But of course, if you live in a Chevron and you're cool with the Jews and you want to have your own thing, okay. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Danny from Tel Aviv. I have a question to you about the beginning of your thing. You talked about, if our strength is in our unity, then is it not the problem with the equality and the burden of the IDF or the taxes between Haredi and secular people that made the seculars go into believing that the Arab community is a greater ally than the Haredi?
He's sure, he's sure that I am bigger netel ba shivyon ba netel lo gorem lechilonim laamin sha'aravim em yoter bnei brit shelanu mi'acharedim. Let me just say, before I even answer that question, let me just ask you, what's in Donnie? What'd you say, Danny? Donnie? Let me ask you this. Are the Arabs a better ally than the Haredim or not?
I'm not sure, but as an Israeli, as a Jew, I believe that if we decide to create a country that is Jewish and Israeli, we should all, as Jews and Israelis, work together. We have Arabs that have a different...
Do they have Shivyon Banetel, by the way? The Arabs do a lot of army?
No, but you
don't... Just asking. You said that they're better, potentially better at... Potentially. Mazel al-Kholim. Mazel al-Kholim.
Biologist.
Ah. He did okay. Ah, nachon. Yeah. Okay. Okay, let me... My time is limited. Shh, chavrim, I'll tell you. Guys, this is... Listen to me. I want to answer your question, so it's not that I want to cut you off, it's because of the time, I promise you. This is a very good question, I'd love to, we could talk about this, we should talk about it for 40 minutes easy. But I'm going to give you my short answer, okay? Short answer is, the Haredim are not big blue and white Zionists, it's true. But they're not our enemy, okay? They're not our enemy. They have a different culture, they have a different brand. A lot of it is about branding. And remember, in Tel Aviv, there is a Haredi Tel Aviv. It's called Bnei Brak. It lives like this. And there's a coexistence there. That's fine. There's like a line. But okay, here's the bottom line. I agree with you that there should be a Shivyon Banetel. And I have a plan. It's a very, again, I love, you're going to hear speakers here throughout the year that give you sophisticated answers. I love simple answers. Intellectually speaking, I prefer simple things than complex things. That's just my shita. My shita is let's simplify. Okay, here's my simple answer. I agree with you. I have a plan like this. Everybody in the country, and I mean everybody, does 2 years. Everybody. Boys, girls, Haredim, Arabs, anybody who lives in our land does 2 years. But 2 years could be a lot of different things. It could be very much any amuta has a right to have שירות לאומי. אין עמותה. So a Haredi amuta that has a good amuta that's recognized by the state can have shirut leumi, and Haredim can work there. Everybody's going to come out, everybody, with a tuda that says, I served 2 years. Ain't because of the Yotze Dofen. Yotze Dofen, you go to jail. Okay? But if you're not a Yotze Dofen, then you're going to do whatever you want. Also, there's some yeshivot for some iluim that are also shirut leumi, because that is a shirut. That is also shirut. That's a shirut for our nation to keep, you see all these books. Not everybody knows all these books. It's a shirut that we have some people that know all the books. That's also an intellectual shirut that some of our people do. But we generally speaking have this thing, everybody gets equalized. There's no Arabs that could go at 18 to college. And because of the Davar. You're a resident of Israel, you have to do 2 years. We equalize that. But to make it that's my plan. That's the Yishai plan for Shivyon Baneto. And it's really Shivyoni. No, there's no. You want to do more? B'vakasha. You want to go to the army and to be in the fighting units? You get more tosefet. You get more money. You get more respect. You get more money. But a Haredi guy is going to take out of his wallet a Medinat Israel card that I did my shirut lumi. No exceptions. Kulam oto davar. Except for, of course, if somebody's sick or whatever it is. But kulam osim oto davar. Okay, that's a simple answer. But don't make the mistake that this problem is like the biggest problem of Israel. It's a problem. Haredim have a different culture. It's not, we have a problem. But it's not like this is what caused October 7th. Okay, that's shtiyot b'mitzvah gvaniyot. Leaving our land and giving to the terrorists, that's what caused October 7th. Okay? And also, by the way, coming closer to a little bit more of a heritage, a Jewish heritage, a little bit more spirituality, a little bit more religion. Do you know, by the way, what the Torah says? What does the Torah say how to make sure that nobody's going to want your land? Do you know what the Torah says? Anybody? Yeah, but there's a specific thing. It was in Parshat Ki Tisa. Anybody know what the Torah says? Huh? No, there's 10. What do you mean?
Of things that won't have our land taken away?
No, there's a specific list. Kitzur, just because of out of time, the Torah says, come 3 times a year to Yerushalayim. Come to Aliyah 3 times a year to Yerushalayim, and nobody will want your land. אני אמרתי, כל היום דיברתי לא על תורה. כל השעה וחצי עכשיו דיברתי. לא הזכרתי את התורה בכלל. עכשיו בסוף השיחה, אני מזכיר תורה לדקה, את אומרת לי, יש דבר שלא מבוסס על תורה. כל השעה וחצי, לא הזכרתי את התורה. לרגע אחד אמרתי עם רעיון, רציתי לגמור עם קצת יהדות, ופתאום הפכתי כאילו אני דיברתי עכשיו עם התנך ומשיח כל היום. מה? מה קרה? I'm out of time, guys. I want to thank you very much. Wait. I'm out of time. I just want to say this. First thing is, marry Jewish, okay? 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 Very important. Please marry Jewish. Thank you. Okay? And have beautiful Jewish babies. That's number one. Number two is that we very much invite you to choose to live in the state of Israel, in the land of Israel. Of course, our Israeli brothers and sisters, you know, if you got to go working in the malls in America for 2 years, okay, but not much longer than that, you know, come back and come and build our country. There'll be plenty of space, plenty of everything for you. And finally, it's very easy to stay in touch with me, Yishai Fleischer, on Twitter, YouTube, etc., all the stuff. So it's easy to stay in touch with me, and I bless you to have a great day. Continue your good work.
All right. Thank you very much to the Shalom Hartman Institute for that opportunity and to those wonderful students with those great questions. Before we get to our Ben Bresky segment, I do want to thank the folks at prohibitionpickle.co.il for delightful delights. And there's been people who have been donating to his family project, helping families.
That's a very nice project, right. Giving to the families of soldiers and things like that.
Yeah. So that is prohibitionpickle.co.il. And it's also a great way to give a little something back to your beloved show hosts. So hint, hint. So there you go. That's prohibitionpickle.co.il. And our good friends at retrowatchguide.com, making awesome watches, bringing back awesome watches from the past into the future. It's really back to the future. That's what's happening.
Nice.
Now. And so that's retrowatchguide.com. And our good friends at Kosher Cycle Tours, touring the land on a bicycle, breathing that fresh, amazing, allergic air, and just really connecting to this holy land on the ground, you know, and not being detached from it, but being really, really seeing the beauty and breathing that amazing air. And thank you, Hashem, for such great days that we've been having recently to give us strength to continue to fight this war, a little bit of Eretz Yisrael smiling upon us. Okay, Ben Bresky has a special, a real special about one of our favorite topics, the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs. And here's the story, brought to you by our intrepid reporter, Ben Bresky, the story of the little girl who went down into the tunnels of the Maarat HaMachpelah, the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs. Ben Bresky, take it away.
This is a moment in Jewish history. Last week, I talked about the Cave of Machpelah, also known as the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs. Much can be said about this historic site, and so I would like to focus on one particular interesting aspect, the time a 12-year-old girl was sent inside the cave, the first person to enter in 700 years. This towering structure, built 2,000 years ago by King Herod the Great, covers the Cave of Machpelah. Inside the building are six cenotaphs, or memorial markers, called in Hebrew tziyun. They are for Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, and Jacob and Leah. As I mentioned last week, Rachel is buried in the tomb of Rachel outside Bethlehem. If you have ever been to the Hall of Isaac and Rebekah, you probably have seen what they call the candle aperture, or also the entrance to the Garden of Eden. It looks kind of like a well, and if you hold your hand or face over the hole, you can feel the backdraft from the underground caves below. Or, as some describe, a whiff of the scent of the Garden of Eden. I have done this and felt the breeze, exactly as described in writings going back to the Middle Ages. But for 700 years, no one had actually been down there, and because the opening is so small, it would take a small person to fit through. In 1967, Israel returned to Hebron and the other historic cities in Judea and Samaria. The defense minister at the time was General Moshe Dayan. As an amateur archaeologist, he wanted the site explored, so he called upon his friend and colleague Yehuda Arbel. At the time, Yehuda Arbel headed the Israeli Security Agency Jerusalem District. He later became famous as a decorated pilot who served the Israeli Air Force for years, helping bring the legendary Dakota planes to Israel. He also led an Israeli rescue mission to help victims of an earthquake in Turkey. This was the year 1968, and he was called in for his amateur cave exploration, something he had done as a hobby with his daughter, Michal. Thus, Michal Arbel, approximately 12 years old, became the first person in modern history to enter the Cave of Machpelah. The following is an excerpt from the English edition of Living with the Bible by Moshe Dayan. He includes Michal's journal entry in which she describes her findings. For 700 years, from the 13th century until June 8, 1967, the structure above the traditional Cave of Machpelah and, of course, the cave itself had been barred to Jews. The closest they were allowed to get to the cave area throughout those centuries was the steps on the outside of the eastern wall, and even then they were permitted to ascend only to the seventh step. From there they could insert a note of petition and supplication into a small hole in the wall, and it would flutter into the cave below. On the fourth day of the Six-Day War, when the Israeli army captured Hebron, the 700-year anti-Jewish ban was broken. Jews ascended beyond the seventh step and entered the building, which marks the tombs of the patriarchs. The building had been erected as a Jewish shrine by King Herod toward the end of the first century. After the Muslim conquest in the 7th century, it was turned into a mosque. It was converted into a church by the Crusaders in the 12th century and reconverted into a mosque after the Mamluk conquest a century and a half later. Its east wing served as a Muslim house of prayer. The west wing holds the tombs, which represent the sepulchres of the patriarchs. The cave lies somewhere beneath the floor of the structure. Jewish visitors came to Hebron in the tens of thousands after the Six-Day War to pay homage at the tombs of the patriarchs after being denied access for so long. Some brought Torah scrolls and a holy ark to house them and turned the West Wing into a synagogue. This created the uneasy situation of a mosque and a synagogue housed cheek by jowl in one building, with Jews and Muslims under the same roof offering their different prayers within sound of one another. we had to devise an arrangement that would enable both communities to worship at the shrine without interference, disturbance, and clash. This would best be done by separating the two prayer halls even further and providing each with its own entrance. During our study of the problem, a proposal was put forth to erect a special synagogue hall just outside the building and link it to the underground story, namely the very underground chamber which, by tradition, holds the patriarchal tombs. The proposal was thought feasible because it was said that this chamber had once had an opening, now sealed, to the outside. If this proved true, it could now be reopened and the scaling bricks replaced by a door. This would make the synagogue a symbolic part of the building housing the shrine, and it would also serve as an entrance for Jewish visitors who could proceed to the tombs without having to go through the mosque. However, to discover whether there was indeed a sealed opening required a close inspection. This was not easy, for the chamber had no door, and in any case, entry was barred. It, or rather its darkness, could only be glimpsed through a grilled aperture in the floor of the mosque, which told us nothing. If entrance was to be effected at all, it could only be through the aperture. The first of such entries was undertaken by Michal, the daughter of one of our people. She was then a slender 12-year-old, able to wriggle through the 11-inch diameter aperture above the chamber. But more than that, she was a bright and courageous little girl who was unafraid not only of ghosts and spirits, their existence was not proven, she said, but also of snakes and scorpions, which were a very real danger. In the classic opening manner of suspense stories, on one dark and gloomy night, she was lowered by rope to the floor of the subterranean area, holding a flashlight in one hand and a camera in the other. She took several photographs and also made notes and sketches. It appeared that there were several later tombs, burial niches, and a flight of steps that did indeed lead to and end at a sealed opening, but it had given entry only to the upper story. There was no sign in the photographs of a scaled exit that had once led directly to the outside. I asked Michal for her photograph as a memento, together with a report of her survey adventure. This is what she wrote. Visit to the Cave of Machpelah. On Wednesday, 9 October 1968, my mother asked me if I would agree to go through a small hole leading into a cave. After I agreed, she told me that it was to be the underground cave of Machpelah. A few hours later, my father woke me. I dressed and went into the car. In the car, I wrapped myself in a blanket. I must have looked like a bundle dumped on the back seat. We set off and reached Hebron. We stopped for a while at the police station, and then we went on to the building of the Cave of Machpelah. I got out of the car, still covered in a blanket, and went into the mosque. I then saw the opening through which I was to enter. It measured and found to be exactly 11 inches in diameter. Ropes were tied round me, and I was given a torch and matches to test the air below, and I was lowered. I landed on a heap of papers and money bills. I found myself in a square room. Opposite me were three tombstones, the middle one higher and more decorated than the other two. There was a small square opening in the wall opposite me. They released more rope, and I went through the opening. I found myself walking through a low, narrow corridor whose walls were cut out of the rock. The corridor had the shape of a box. Its corners were right-angled. At the end of the corridor was a stairwell, and the stairs ended in a built wall. I left, was drawn through the aperture, recounted all I had seen, and went down again. I measured the narrow corridor, and it was 34 paces long. When I counted the stairs, there were 15 when I went up, but 16 when I went down. I counted them again, going up and down 5 times, but the results were the same. The riser of each step was 10 inches. I went up the stairs the 6th time and knocked on the ceiling. I received answering knocks in return, and they pulled me back. They gave me a camera, and I went down again and photographed the square room, the tombstones, the corridor, and the staircase. I went up again, got a pencil and paper, returned below, and made sketches. I measured the room. It was 6 paces by 5. The width of each tombstone was 1 pace, and the space between the tombstones was also 1 pace. The width of the corridor was 1 pace, and its height was about 1 meter. I was pulled back up. On the way, I dropped the torch, and so I went down for it and was drawn back up again. Michal. Although we did not find the opening we were looking for, I am sure that the Chronicles of Israel will record with pride this visit of Michal, the first visit by a Jew to this site in 700 years. That was from Living with the Bible by Moshe Dayan. Moshe Dayan's idea of having Jewish prayer services in the underground cave below never worked out. Today, the site has separate sections with separate entrances for Muslims and Jews, and each religion gets 10 days a year corresponding to holidays and special days to reserve the site. Today, Michal Arbel is a respected professor at Tel Aviv University, where she lectures on literature and is an expert on the works of Nobel Prize laureate S.Y. Agnon. This has been A Moment in Jewish History. Thank you to Yishai Fleischer. Thank you to all the listeners, and shalom.
All right, Malka, thank you very much. That's an amazing story. Only two things I want to say before we go, Malka. First is to thank Tabitha, Ben Bresky, Yocheved Seidman, Lou when we're live, Moshe Herman, and David on the social media for rocking the content and making it available to the world. Thank you for all the folks out there who are part of it. Please connect to us. If you want to support us, we have a lot of projects going on, including book writing, which we need support of right now, and there's good dedications available there, including the Tomb of Rut and Yishai in Hebron, and including this radio show and many other projects, some public, some less so. And so, and
I don't
so,
think some people realize that you can dedicate a show.
You can dedicate a show.
Which means you can pick a date and go, I want that show to be dedicated to fill in the blank.
That's right. Your beloved ones. So there you go. The other thing I want to do is just one little word of Torah, Malka, and that is this week's Torah portion finishes off the book of Exodus.
Oh,
And then we enter Leviticus, which is by most accounts really the hardest book. You know what I mean? It's a hard book to, and there's the Leviticus type people, but not everybody is a
baseball fans,
right? So, and it is God's word, and it is the way to serve God. And notice that it's the middle book, so it's like the real heart, right. The heart of the matter. And there's amazing Torah portions, but there's also some hard stuff there. You know, Tzarat, what's it called?
Leprosy
and the whole business. So there's all kinds of challenges that we're going to be facing soon, but I just want to finish off the book of Exodus just by saying that the Ramban calls it the book of Geula, and he says it's not because of the redemption from Egypt, the Exodus. It's because the book ends with God's presence coming down into the tabernacle.
Nice.
That is, ladies and gentlemen, in simple terms, the goal of humanity, to draw God into this world. That's what we got to do. And that's why this book ends with like the tabernacle being built, with Bezalel making all the vessels and vestments. And then in the end, finally, boom, God's presence says, I can withstand you guys. And I could live amongst you without frying all of you. And that is a great achievement, that God's presence in this lower domain. Wow. The Jewish people have achieved something. The world's at a different state. And that's a state that we're yearning for. It's not there right now, but it's...
We might not be far off.
We might not be far off, but it's going to be a big tshuva. The world's got to do a lot of tshuva. That's what I wanted to say, Malka, that this show is really about just that. Like, there's a lot of anti-Semitism, a lot of bad stuff. Israel's at war. But in the end, the bottom line is to bring God's presence in this world, into this world. That's what it's about. And that's what we're doing. And that's the end of the book of the book of Exodus, the book of Shemot. And so I want to bless everybody that indeed, in this last part of the book of Shemot, we have the zchut, we are zoche, to indeed do that with every action that we take, with every word that we say, with every project that we take upon ourselves, that at the end the goal is to bring God's presence into this world. That's my blessing to all of you wherever you are, including my non-Jewish brothers and sisters out there around the world, and of course my Jewish family and my Judean family and all the good folks that are part of this great thing. So stay tuned, stay strong, be proud right now, be proud, be loud. Push back on the bad guys. They are afraid of you inside. Show them that you roar. Show them that you're connected to something that nobody can put out. No water could put out this fire of love, of connectivity. Right now, more than ever, we got to get out there and show that pride and bring Jewish young people to see, and all of our young people, to see that we're not afraid of the baddies, that the darkness is shooed away by just a little bit of light.
We're not going to mold ourselves around them.
That's right. Well, we're going to, maybe when our shoe kicks their, you know, there'll be a little molding right there. In any case, God bless you folks wherever you are. Lots of love and lots of blessings from the land of blessings. Malka Fleischer, thank you very much.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.